Hey there, and welcome to episode number 2 of The Doctor Who Show, the audio fanzine where too much Doctor Who is barely enough. If you're joining us from episode 1, welcome back. Hello, g'day, hola, and so on. We had some lovely comments about that episode on social media, and as always, if you want to comment more formally and be read out on the show, do email us something at hello@dwshow.net. This episode is a bit less sprawling than last episode, but only a bit. You know, it's something I think about quite a lot when I listen to podcasts or when I make podcasts. Is this too short? Is this too long? Are there too many episodes? Are there too little? But I think the nature of this show means that by the time you tack a one-hour interview to a 30-minute Hootiques Roadshow, you've passed the one-and-a-half-hour mark without blinking before we even do, you know, Letter Lords or our A to Z or any of the reviews and so on. So I think this show will always sit around the two-hour mark at least, if not the two-and-a-half-hour mark. And I think that's one of the reasons this works well as a monthly. It comes out and you have a good amount of time to listen to it before there's another one knocking on the door. So I'm pretty happy with our length. I'm pretty happy with the amount of episodes that will come out a year. I think 12 plus any specials we do. And I hope you like that too. This episode, I think you'll start to get a feel for our format as it beds in, and we have all the same segments as last episode. Probably the only difference is Lex isn't back doing a 11th Doctor comic, because there's been no 11th Doctor comic since she last recorded, but I'm sure she'll be back next time. Other than that, this is all the same stuff, with some different guests, of course. And with that in mind, without any further ado, let's get into the interview of this episode. This time around, I want to talk to a younger Doctor Who fan, someone who really loves the classic era, to try and understand why, what drew them to it, what parts appeal the most. They're the questions I'll be asking, so let's see here.
Hello.
Hey Hayden, it's Rob Irwin calling from the Doctor Who Show. Is now a good time to chat?
Yeah, absolutely. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And it's good because, you know, as we've discussed offline, I do want to chat with someone younger. Well, younger than me anyway.
Easy.
That's not hard. Who's really, really into the classic era of Doctor Who and why they're into it. So are you our man for that?
I do believe I am, yes. I'm the right man for the job. I knew my calling would come one day, and here it is.
Good. Well, it would have been a short interview if you said otherwise, so...
Yeah, it's like, no.
Okay. Let's start, though, with some background on yourself so the readers get a feel for you. How old are you, and where will listeners know you from in the world of Doctor Who?
I'm 26 years old, and listeners will know me from my being one of the four faces of delusion on the Diddly Dun podcast.
Very good. And I think you also might do some scribblings for a certain fanzine.
Oh, yes, of course. For the last 6 years, I've sort of sporadically contributed to the Celestial Toy Room, which is the fanzine of the Doctor Who Appreciation Society. I've also contributed... you just opened a can of worms here now, Rob. I'm just gonna spiel off everything.
It's what I'm best at.
I've also contributed short stories and features to Doctor Who Online, which led to me being interviewed on BBC News about the departure of Matt Smith back in 2013.
I've seen that, yeah. All right, so now with your pedigree established, let's get into this topic I want to explore. And the reason I want to explore it is because when I was young, when I was growing up in the 80s, I would look at Doctor Who. And I would think, oh, this is so daggy. This is so embarrassing to show other people. Like, I love it. You know, I am absolutely adoring this, but I don't think I can show this to anyone. I was embarrassed of it at times. And as I've gotten older, I've looked at people younger than me who get into it, and I think, gosh, what do you see in it? Like, I know what I liked, but what do you see in it? Because you've grown up with Star Wars, or you've grown up with whatever movies that have come since, or TV shows that have come since. And so I guess my opening huge question is, how did you get into Doctor Who?
Doctor Who, I think, had always been there, but it was quite subliminal. I do have very, very, very faint memories of being about, probably about 3 or 4 years old, and seeing John Pertwee being attacked by Morris dancers on television. And of course, I knew John Pertwee primarily as Wurzel Gummidge, as we would over here on... But I think that burnt into my memory because it was such a weird vision, such a weird image of seeing this man in a cloak with bouffant white hair being attacked by people clonking, you know, the jingle of bells and the clonking of wood on wood, as Rimmer says in Red Dwarf, you know, and they're yeah, so that stayed with me for just being incredibly bizarre. And then I remember a trip to the Natural History Museum when I was probably about five with my school. Mm-hmm. And they had a dinosaur exhibit there. And at that point, they had like a little TV screen on this exhibit where they were showing sort of dinosaurs in popular culture. And they showed that bit from Invasion of the Dinosaurs. The good grief, it's a Stegosaurus and all this kind of stuff. And it's very... And I remember looking at it thinking, oh, that looks pretty interesting, you know. But then it really, you know, Doctor Who really did come into my life when I was 7 years old and the TV movie was just about to air. And that weekend I'd gone up to Warwickshire, which is in the Midlands in the UK, and we've had a trip to my great-grandmother's. She lived in an old folks' home. And like you do when you're seven, you know, you don't really want to sit around and, you know, talk to old people. sounds harsh, but when you're that age, you look around for things to do when you're there. So, yeah. And I remember on the table, there was that week's Radio Times. It just sort of flopped open so that the centre page was sort of staring me in the face from this table. It's a bit like that scene in Pulp Fiction when they open the box and that gold light shines out. I mean, in my mind's eye, there, that magazine has gold light shimmering, almost like regenerative energy, you know.
Wow.
Spawning out of the top. And I remember looking into it, and it was this about 16-page booklet stapled into the centrefold, and it was called Doctor Who: Return of a Time Lord. Mm-hmm. And it had all these floating heads, these floating faces of these different people. And I remember, basically, because I'd always had a bit of an interest in science fiction anyway. Of course, you know, I was brought up during the 90s when obviously Star Trek ruled the television. Had things like Sliders and, like I've already said, Red Dwarf as well, which I used to stay up and watch with my parents, even though I probably shouldn't have done.
Not at that age. Naughty, naughty.
No. But I pointed out to my dad, and I said, Doctor Who, what's this? And he said, oh, you know, television show and everything. I said, well, who's Doctor Who? Which one of these is Doctor Who? And he said, all of them.
Right.
And at that point, I was like, ooh, okay, that's intriguing. And I think that whole weekend, building up, because it was on the bank holiday Monday that the TV movie was shown over here, so I went to visit my great-grandmother on the Saturday, and so I basically had 48 hours to brush up using just this booklet, essentially. And by the end of the Sunday, I've pretty much memorised how long Tom Baker had been in the role, how many episodes mm-hmm. William Hartnell had starred in, that the moon base was Patrick Troughton's, you know, highest story with regards to viewing figures in the UK, and it was all this kind of stuff. And it submerged itself within me.
And what do you think it was about? Was it that there was this history that you could delve into, like you're reading about the ancient Romans or something? You know, there's just all this material that you need to absorb and you're interested in, or was it something else that maybe just grabbed you?
I think it was the history of the show because, I mean, by that point there was eight different faces playing the same character, and you think, well, this is a bit different. Hmm. You know, this is something I can really get my teeth into. Looking at the pictures and trying to assemble, you know, what their personalities would be like just from looking at the picture, you know, and seeing a robot dog and thinking, oh, that's cool, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And it's the monsters as well. I thought, obviously, like I said, you know, I'd seen Star Trek, but I think Star Trek, I mean, you can maybe list four memorable sort of villains and aliens from The Next Generation. With Doctor Who, you can probably list about 20, I reckon, yeah. Quite easily.
Yeah.
So there was that as well. And, I mean, we did used to play Daleks in the playground. There used to be these little, like, wicker baskets that used to hold, like, tennis balls and other things that we could play, like beanbags and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Like tiny beanbags, sorry, not massive ones. Can you imagine seven-year-olds hurtling those? Yeah. And we used to empty them, turn them up, and put them over our heads and just walk around with our arms out going, exterminate, exterminate. And I never really knew what that meant. because I think the older children did, because obviously I was born in June 1989. Now, in June 1989, when I read it up, I think Survival was just going into recording. I think it was just going into production. They'd just finished Ghostlight and they were going in to record, obviously, the last ever episode. But the older kids who were maybe, you know, sort of maybe 3 or 4 years older, who were obviously born 85, would remember bits of the Sylvester McCoy era, so they'd know who the Daleks were.
That's right, yeah.
So you had the older kids were sort of playing it, and I was thinking, oh, you know, I'd like to get a bit more involved. I mean, it's just quite fun putting a wicker basket on your head and running around saying exterminate, but I want to get to know this a little bit more. So I think it's the fact that there were little nuggets in sort of the culture at my school that sort of got me into it, but it was mostly, it was the history of the show, yeah.
Just a question that popped into my head while we were talking about the history of it. Did you feel the same way when you came across James Bond for the first time and then realised, oh, there have been other guys who have played this guy?
I was so confused when I watched. I think the first James Bond film I saw, I think, might have been Thunderball.
Right.
And then the one that I saw afterwards was one of the Roger Moore films. And I thought, what's going on here? You know, why is he different? Why is nobody blinking an eye? And obviously because it's all about spies, you know, and espionage, I thought, this guy's a spy. No one's seen it yet. I thought maybe they'd sort of changed the, you know, Roger Moore had killed off Sean Connery and now he'd assumed his role and everyone just thought he looked like him, strangely. No, I did for a while think that perhaps, you know, James Bond was a Time Lord as well and regenerated... Yeah, Sean Connery bites the bullet, literally, at the end of Diamonds Are Forever and regenerates into Roger Moore, and he staggers through Live and Let Die with, you know, post-regenerative trauma. But there you go.
That would explain a lot about that film. But so, anyway, so to go back to Doctor Who, you're 7 years old and the TV movie's coming out, which makes me feel positively ancient because I'd finished university at this point.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a habit of doing this when I'm on, you know, podcasts and things. I mean, I have a habit of making people feel older than they actually are. So
I know, but this is why I thought of you when it came to this topic, you see. You know, I thought when it comes to this topic, the one person I want to talk to is Hayden. So here we are. So you're 7 years old going into this. I'm 21 years old going into this TV movie. And I think, you know, on the last episode of Who Wars that we did, Andy was talking about seeing the new Star Wars film and how he felt about it. And, you know, how he felt about it, he acknowledged, would be quite different to how he would have felt about it if he was 8 years old or 9 years old or whatever it might be. Mm. So I've got a feeling that we've probably come at this TV movie at quite different times of our lives and maybe experienced it differently. So for you, when you've read this magazine, you've brushed up on all your knowledge, you've watched the TV movie, what are you thinking after you've seen it?
Probably not as good as I'd built it up to be in my head.
Really?
To be perfectly honest, yeah. I was quite... It's funny because the elements I liked back then are not necessarily the elements I like now. So the violence was a big thing. I mean, as a 7-year-old boy, I, you know, loved explosions, and we always like play fighted in the playground and everything. But I didn't like... Even though it was only implied in the edit when it went out here that the Master had snapped Bruce's wife's neck, you could kind of imagine what had happened, and your brain sort of fills in the blanks, you know, the missing frames. It's a bit like, you know, Janet Leigh in the shower in Psycho. Mm-hmm. You know, your mind tells you that you've seen the blade penetrate the skin, but actually it hasn't. It's just your mind's filling in the blanks. And that sort of happened for me, and I found that quite creepy, but at the same time, you know, in a rather morose way, quite cool. And also, you know, the spitting of the poisonous phlegm and, you know, that acidic stuff that Grace gets on her arm. And I actually, at the time, I didn't mind the romance element as well, because it's so integrated into you when you're watching TV as a kid that there's always going to be a love interest. If you put a boy and a girl together in any sort of TV show at that time, you'd think, oh, you know, ooh, they might go off and get married. And, I mean, I also liked the regeneration as well, because I liked seeing this, you know, older Doctor, this previous Doctor, and it felt quite special to watch my first regeneration in the very first you know, live episode that I had seen as such. But now, actually, I really don't dislike all of them, all those elements. So as I've got older, the things that I liked about it have changed. I mean, the one constant, actually, is that I thought Paul McGann was very good.
Yeah.
And I really, really liked Paul McGann. And I've, you know, I think I've said to you before on when I interviewed you for our podcast, and I said I couldn't get into the EDAs. Well, it's different with Big Finish. And actually reading back now, there's some Eighth Doctor books that I can read and, you know, that I do enjoy. But at the time, I thought, oh, this Doctor's great, but I couldn't get into him in through any other media. They used to do, around about that time, Radio Times used to do like a 3 or 4 panelled comic strip.
Right.
I think only ran for several weeks. I can't remember it being there for that long. And I didn't read them.
Oh.
I kind of wanted to see this Doctor, you know, visually. I found it quite difficult. I enjoyed his adventures in Doctor Who magazine, in the comic strip, but that was a little bit later on. So at this point, I really liked this Doctor, but I thought, I didn't feel like the show was going to come back. I thought that was just a one-off. So I suppose it's quite anticlimactic as well.
Well, I guess...
What I was really...
No, go on, please.
What I was really interested in was the 7 other Doctors beforehand, because I'd read up about them that weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the ones that I thought, I'll make it my mission to watch as much as I can.
Well, that's where I was going to go with my next question. So you've watched this TV movie, you've got positive feelings about it in some ways, and maybe not so positive feelings in others. What's the next step? Is it to go to your local library and grab some John Pertwee episodes? Is it to start reading Target novels? What's the next step for you as a younger person in the mid-90s?
About a month or two later, I was taking... it's so haphazard, this, but I injured myself while taking part in the school sports day.
Oh, dear.
And I had to... you know, go into it sounds such a Charlie Chaplin thing to do, but I had to go into hospital overnight. And when I came out, I, you know, got bed rest or, you know, sofa rest for a couple of weeks before I went back to school. And that weekend, my grandparents came to visit me, and as a present, they brought me a video. And, you know, opened the packaging, saw the video was a Doctor Who video, and it was Snake Dance, which isn't a very conventional episode or story, sorry, to watch.
Not at all.
As your first sort of entrance into the classic era. But the thing that surprised me the most was the theme tune.
Okay.
The theme tune, I hadn't taken much notice, I don't think, back when I'd seen a TV movie a couple of months previously. But when I listened to the theme tune, you know, that Peter Howell version,
mm-hmm.
It really, really grabbed me. And I absolutely adored, and to this day, I love the outro to the Peter Howell Imagining as such, with, you know, the middle eight when it goes very sort of twinkly and very, you know, sort of euphoric, and
yeah.
I really, really liked that, and that grabbed me. But I think it was that. I also think Peter Davison, because he was quite a relatable Doctor, because he was, you know, quite a young guy, so he was, you know, slightly closer to my age, so he was a bit like an older brother. I know it's been said before, but in that story I felt like he was an older brother, and he was an older brother to me and also to Nyssa and Tegan.
He's a bit like McGann as well. If McGann's been the Doctor you've seen the most of at that point, I think out of all the classic Doctors, he's probably the closest to a McGann.
Yes, he is, yeah. So there's a slight relation there, not so much to their age, but also because I think they showed a bit of vulnerability in, you know, all throughout Davison's era, and of course McGann in the TV movie as well. You know, he is fallible. So I liked that, and these hints that the Doctor hadn't quite defeated this, whatever this Mara thing was in the past, and now it come back to haunt his companion, to the point that I thought, ooh, you know, is Tegan a companion who you can trust?
Right.
You know,
interesting.
Can you actually, you know, so if I picked up another Davison video, would I be reading through and thinking, you know, Tegan's at some point is going to snap again and try and kill the Doctor? Of course, that never happened, and then they nearly buggered it up with Turlough. But anyway, that's you know, that's it, really. But it was that video, and I don't think I had any other Doctor Who related merchandise, I think, probably until Christmas. I think 96 was quite a slow year getting off the ground. And then I got the Android Invasion on video, and then very soon afterwards got the Green Death. And I think it was with the Green Death that I really started seeing, you know, this mythology come to life. You know, it's the Doctor, it's the giant maggots, it's Joe Grant, it's UNIT. And to this day, it's still one of my favourite classic stories. And then after that, it really kicked off. You know, I started seeing Doctor Who. It's a bit like I'd had a perception filter on. A bit like I had that, you know, these Doctor Who books and, you know, videos and merchandise had the TARDIS key on there, and I couldn't quite see them. Mm-hmm. Because all of a sudden, I started spotting Doctor Who in the shops. I started spotting books. I started spotting videos. But of course, I mean, over here, in the 90s, the only way to watch Doctor Who regularly was if you had satellite television.
Right.
So if you had, it was on a channel called UK Gold, and we didn't have that. So, I mean, I used to occasionally, you know, throw a bit of a paddy and, you know, say, oh, I can see, you know, Doctor Who's going to be on, but there's no way of recording it. And, you know, there was an occasion where I literally thought that I was never going to see the Three Doctors because I'd missed it. And
I guess it wasn't out on video at that point, perhaps.
Well, I mean, because I didn't have the disposable income, I was really relying on, you know, birthdays and Christmases, basically, for my fix. The only pocket money I got covered, I think probably in a month, covered two or three Beano comics, and also DWM. And DWM actually sort of fed me more of this addiction that I was slowly giving into, because I remember the first DWM issue that I got had an article in there saying, and it was called 20 Moments When You Realise You're Watching the Greatest Television Show Ever. I think it was something like that. I might have tweaked that title a bit. And seeing these little telly snaps of stuff like Tom Baker's Regeneration, gosh, and, you know, Sylvester McCoy in The Happiness Patrol saying, throw your gun away. You know, that very first scene aboard the TARDIS in An Unearthly Child and all this stuff. And it was incredible. And just thinking, you know, I really did make it my mission to seek out as much of this as I could, with varying degrees of success.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, when you're starting to pick up more and more of these videos, what sort of supplemental material you might have had, whether it was a reference guide or something, but it sounds like Doctor Who magazine was filling that role. And it was similar for me too. I remember my first step into fandom was buying Doctor Who magazine number 119. Has Perry on the cover in a yellow striped blazer with the longer hair from Trial of a Time Lord. And although I'd watched Doctor Who and discussed it with my older brother many years prior to that, I think that December 1986 issue and the ones that came after is what really fed and sort of educated me. There were reference books as well, a particular Peter Haining book called Doctor Who: A Celebration.
Yeah.
So I guess for you, was it the magazine, or did you pick up a reference book here and there to sort of just flesh out and sort of understand what other episodes were out there, or did Target novels start to come into the equation at this point?
Oh, definitely reference books to start off with. Mm-hmm. We had a newsagent, and it occasionally sold books, but it was always books that were sort of out of date by two or three years, and I picked up the Doctor Who yearbook, which I think was for the 1995, because I remember the very last sort of paragraph in the book, it was talking about this film that was coming up, and obviously that being a TV movie. But looking through and seeing just which stories corresponded with which Doctor, and I didn't really read the text as such. I mean, it had a couple of comic book stories in there. One with Beep the Meep, I seem to remember.
These yearbooks, as I recall them, were sort of the 90s version of the old annuals. Am I remembering them correctly?
You are, yeah. I mean, this yearbook as such, I've actually got it in my hands now. It was more, it centred more on the sort of the production side of things. So you'd have like about half a page taken up with all the details for each season. So what serial number it was, what the story was called, how many episodes it had, when it was in production, you know, transmission dates. So for someone like me with a slightly, you know, almost a slightly autistic mind, I completely drank this up. I really did. And, you know, seeing what the working titles for things were. And I remember the text saying the Second Doctor was given a baptism of fire in the power of the Daleks. And I thought, Well, that doesn't sound very nice. Not obviously realising what that saying meant. So
of course,
it was quite,
of course.
Yeah. But it was, no, it was utterly incredible. And also, you know, seeing these pictures and everything looked, I mean, to quote the show, it all looked ancient and forever.
Mm. Yeah.
It looked so otherworldly. I mean, even the pictures taken from, you know, like season 25 that they showed, it's already looking dated, but that gives it a very intriguing edge, I found, you know, and I really, 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 really wanted to, you know, watch as many of these episodes as I could. And I actually had, I used to go to a shop called The Bookworm, which was on the South Coast, where my grandparents lived, and they'd, you know, their granddad would take me in there, give me like a pound to go and buy, you know, some Target books after we'd found them. And I remember the first one I had was Image of the Fendahl. And I don't actually remember reading that, but I do remember reading and latching onto Doctor Who and the Cybermen.
Right.
And really loving that novelisation. And then actually thinking, well, this is a much more affordable way of me, you know, sort of filling in these blanks. I literally had a checklist where, you know, after getting the yearbook, I'd write down the stories and which Doctor, you know, who was in them and which companions were in them, and literally just tick them off as I went. After I'd read the book or, you know, seen the videos. The video collection grew over a few years to, I reckon I probably had about 30 stories.
Wow, yeah.
At one point, which I suppose actually isn't too bad.
That's pretty good.
It was, yeah, I mean, birthday presents, birthday money and Christmas presents, I suppose. So these were really the only things I'd really spend on. Other, you know, there were distractions, you know, big football fan, but also the Star Wars special editions came out in 97.
That's right.
So for that summer, especially because it was over my birthday, for that summer, I really was a Star Wars head.
Yeah.
Definitely. But I think for the rest of the time, I mean, because that was only three films, it's amazing to think, actually, there's been four since then.
It is.
Which is quite incredible.
It is.
But because there were only three films and I could sort of go back and revisit them as and when, Doctor Who, you know, that felt quite complete to me, but Doctor Who didn't. So imagine how I felt when I first found out that there were missing episodes.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, very, very bad.
Well, you know, this does tie back to what I was talking about earlier in the conversation about growing up with Star Wars, for example, and Star Wars, even from 1977 onwards, had amazing effects and had a lot of money spent on it. And Doctor Who never did. So how do you think you reconcile that in your mind, watching, on one hand, Star Wars and all of that great stuff in there, and then watching a Doctor Who episode where the set's wobbling or it just looks terrible? You know, As I said, I used to love it, but I'd be embarrassed to show my friends. How did you feel about it as a fan?
Well, I always thought if my friends were interested in Star Wars, then that would be a window into introducing them to Doctor Who, because it was science fiction, you know, exactly the same as Star Wars. And I know that, you know, Doctor Who never did the dogfights in space, and like you said, you know, the stunning visual effects. But what Doctor Who did have was character, and it had plot, and it had story, and it had intrigue as well. I mean, one of the things that really captured me was when I started watching the black and white stories, because it was so different. I mean, you didn't really, unless you watched early morning reruns of stuff like The Munsters, or I remember Flash Gordon, the old 1930s series of that, or Laurel and Hardy, you didn't see anything else that was black and white. Black and white was really frowned upon, actually, I think, in the 90s.
Well, they're trying to colourise it all the time. They were that embarrassed about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Not Doctor Who specifically, but in general. You know, Hollywood was trying to colour movies all the time. It was weird.
But the fact that Doctor Who was also in colour meant there was this entirely different, you know, otherworldly feel to it. I always felt like the black and white episodes felt a bit more filmic.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they held a little bit of an advantage over, let's say, stuff, you know, sort of from the early 70s, let's say like the early John Pertwee episodes. You know, I'm sort of talking to think, you know, like Terror of the Autons and that kind of thing. But honestly, when I used to watch Doctor Who, I never really looked at the visual effects. I was always invested in the characterization of these, you know, these brilliant people. You know, you got this man who, well, unless you, you know, unless you see John Pertwee, you know, kicking ass in the Green Death, you think he's not a very violent person. He seems to get by using words as weapons, not you know, not guns or knives or anything like that. So I found that quite inspiring, and I really, really liked that. And it was just also the fact that these people who you were watching, you could kind of look up to.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, you could never really associate with the Doctor. The Doctor was so otherworldly. But the companions, you really could. You could invest in them. You could be, you know, you could follow the story through them. And then, you know, be safe in the knowledge that you're going to get back in that, you know, wonderful Type 40 TARDIS, you know, by the end of it. So it's quite, you know, I'd never really looked at it visual effects wise. My parents used to, you know, sort of laugh at it when they'd watch, you know, because obviously I didn't have a TV. I was too young to have a TV in my bedroom. And I don't think we had a video player in the TV in my parents' room. So the only way I could watch Doctor Who was if I asked to watch, you know, a whole story for like an hour and a half, or, you know, 2 hours on a weekend.
It's interesting. I was just going to say, you mentioned the black and white era feeling filmic, and I'm just thinking about some episodes in my head, and I think the black and white hides a lot of problems, where if those episodes are in colour, they might not look as good. And I think of when they might go on location in the black and white era. I think of, is it The Invasion, where they're being chased around by cops in Jaguar police cars or something like that?
Yeah.
And it's in black and white, and it looks so cool. But if that was in colour, would it look as cool? It might not, you know?
No, certainly not. I mean, I actually, one of the episodes, even though I didn't feel like I could relate to this Doctor, but, you know, my grandparents really admired him, I really, really liked the War Machines. And the reason for that was because it felt actually, even though at this point, God, it was only 30... trying to do the mental arithmetic now, about 32 years old. Actually, that's scary.
Yeah.
Good grief. So that's a bit like something from 1984 now, oh my God, that's mad. Wow. Anyway, yeah, so watching something like that, you know, about computers linking up all around the world and then taking over, I was thinking, oh, we've just got the internet at school.
Yeah.
Hang on, this is a bit relatable. And I really, really loved that. And I remember seeing those location shots of the War Machine going around, you know, killing the man in the phone booth, and, you know, the Doctor and Ben, and those sort of like that, what I like to call the prototype unit soldiers that they're with in that episode, you know, trying to capture it in that strange, like, roped-off ring that they make. You know, it was quite... But it was really, really good. I really, really enjoyed it. And actually, I used to show it to my friends. I used to show, if I had a friend come over, he'd say, oh, look, can we just watch one episode? You know, and the one that really grabbed not just me, but a whole host of us was, I had a birthday party where I showed them episode 2 of The Abominable Snowmen.
Okay.
Which looked brilliant. And even though it was a very damaged print, I mean, I can't believe just how well the restoration team have done to, you know, spruce that up over time. But genius. But to watch that, and to watch, you know, a Yeti, you know, straight away you're in the action, you know, you've got Jamie knocking down the stanchion, you've got, you know, the rocks falling on the Yeti, but it gets back up, this thing's indestructible, and it's a brilliant episode, brilliant episode, and they all loved it. So, you know, my peers weren't affected by it being in black and white, or, you know, when they're trying to capture the Yeti and they're just basically hitting a man in a costume with sticks, you know, and trying to make it look really heavy and trying to make it look really dramatic. You know, no, we absolutely loved it. We really did. It was, I mean, unfortunately for me, they all tended, you know, to forget about it the next, you know, sort of the next week at school when we spoke. But I did always feel a little bit like I don't know. No one was ever as much of a big fan as I was when I was at school.
Right.
They'd sort of watch it with me, and I used to do this thing. This is terribly embarrassing, but
do tell.
But I'll mention it. I used to have a burgundy dressing gown.
Right.
And when I watched Doctor Who, I'd put the burgundy dressing gown on.
Yes.
Take the belt out and put it around my neck, so I looked like the Fourth Doctor from season 18.
Ah, that's sweet. That is sweet.
It's amazing that I've ever had a girlfriend.
I
don't think she knows that. She does now.
Oh, gosh. Oh, look, we've all been there in the early days of my fandom when I was in the local club. We made a fan film, and they cast me as the Fifth Doctor. And they're going to explain it somehow. They're going to take part of a Fifth Doctor episode and then pretend he got zapped and then turned into me somehow. It was quite strange. So, look, dressing up and pretending to be the Doctor, yeah, we've all been there. And if we say we haven't, we're lying.
That sounds like an amateur dramatics adaptation of Seven Keys to Doomsday there.
It does in a way, doesn't it? I wonder if that's where the person who wrote it got the idea from, now that I think about it.
Directed by Tony Martin?
Something like that, yeah.
Oh, that's terrible. I'm shaming myself there.
Well, but, the fella who wrote this script for our local group now actually works in television, so I might go and put that to him. Okay, now we were talking about the Target novels, and we're also talking about how you enjoyed in the episode you're watching the characterizations and such, you know, in lieu of big special effects and things like that. Do you think, and this may have come up in your Target episode of Diddly Dumb as well, do you think reading the Target novels actually enhanced those TV episodes, maybe even to the point where you thought the TV episodes were better than they were simply because you knew the story so well through the Target novel and you knew the characters so well and you weren't relying on sort of B-grade actors at times just on the screen?
That's no way to speak about Deborah Watling.
Not so much the main casts, but often, you know, the guest actors have sometimes not been the best over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, I completely agree. Something like the Cybermen novelization, which I said, you know, which I brought up before, I brought the Cybermen the early years, VHS, and watched those two episodes, you know, the episodes 2 and 4 that unfortunately are the only two that have survived. But I already knew the plot so well that I knew what was coming up, but I wanted to see and I was intrigued at how it compared. So it was comparing and contrasting. I remember reading about the dinosaur in Doctor Who and the Cave Monsters and thinking, oh, this is going to be incredible, you know, that, and then seeing it on TV when it's a CSO man in a costume and thinking, oh, okay. Yeah. Never did it dampen, though. It only ever enhanced, I think.
Yeah. I mean, earlier in this chat, you were talking about seeing Pertwee accosted by Morris dancers. And for those not in the know out there, that's a scene from The Demons.
Ironically, nothing to do with the show. It was just, I was just walking past a park.
Now you're making me lose my train of thought. No.
Sorry.
That's quite okay. And with The Demons, I read that first as a book, as the Target novel. And right. I thought it was amazing, you know, because I was only, I don't know, 10 or 11 at the time. So I'm reading about, you know, these dark satanic type powers and all this stuff that's happening and, you know, digging up this this place in the dead of night and the TV crew's there. And, oh, man, I thought this was just amazing. And then when I saw the episode, which I know a lot of people don't rate, and even this past weekend on J.R. Southall's Facebook wall, people are saying how much they don't rate the Demons at all. But we first saw that in our little local club as a black and white, because at the time not all of the episodes were available in colour, so it was screened on Australian TV entirely in black and white.
Oh my word.
So I knew this story inside out, and I was watching it in scary black and white. I thought it was brilliant. And even now, watching it in colour in the modern day, without having read the novel for years, I still really, really love The Demons. And I think it's because I kicked it off by reading the Target novel first.
They can certainly elevate certain stories. I mean, we spoke about this. I mean, take something like Doctor Who and the Doomsday Weapon is far better than Colony in Space.
Yeah.
I can't really think. I think when it got to the later books, stuff like, you know, Earthshock and The Visitation, I remember reading them thinking, I'm not entirely sure about these. And then all of a sudden, seeing the actual televised stories and thinking, these are miles better. I think those earlier books had more detail and they expanded on those worlds a hell of a lot more, you know, fourfold. But when it came to the later books, until I reckon probably...
You're going to say, like, Remembrance of the Daleks or something?
I was actually, yeah, and I was also trying to think of the what's the second? Oh, the second Daleks Master Plan novelization, the Mutation of Time.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, when it got so the later Target books sort of picked up again, but they sort of early to mid 80s, they did dwindle a bit. I found that, but then I found the stories more enjoyable as a consequence. So it was a win-win, really. If the book wasn't that good, then the story would be better, and if the book was really good, then it only enhanced what I saw when I finally saw the televised version.
That's right. That's right. Okay, now we're talking about collecting the VHS stories, and you got around 30, you mentioned.
Yeah.
What happened when DVD came along? Did you go, oh my God, I'm going to have to replace all of these? Or did you see the benefits of DVD? Did you see the commentaries and the little documentaries, although they were a bit thin on the ground at first, but then they started to really make some great stuff. Did you get into collecting the DVDs and flogging off your VHS, or what happened in that sort of... I guess that's probably really late 90s, but probably early 2000s.
Well, it sort of happened in my own personal wilderness years, I'd have to say.
Ooh, tell me more.
Doctor Who, I'm around about sort of late 2000. My youngest sister had been born, and I was facing a few life changes. New sister, new school coming up as well. And I remember... as a present from my parents, how good myself and my sister had been, they brought us VHS, and they actually bought me The Invasion of Time. And I really disliked it. And it was the first time that I had actually, out of all these Doctor Who VHSs that I had, it was the first one that I watched and thought, no, I don't like this. And around that time, because I had so many changes going on, I sort of moved away from Doctor Who. And I think I think one of the reasons is when you're a teenager, you're so desperate to, fit in with your peers. You conform. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, things like Doctor Who and Beano and all the rest of it were out of the door. And, hair gel, Linkin Park, hoodies and chains, from our jeans were sort of in. And that sort of replaced everything. But as I got to about 14, 15, I think I was 15. We had a break at school to do work experience, and I was just working in a shop for a couple of weeks. During that lunch period, I went out and went to the local HMV, and in there I saw that the Five Doctors Special Edition DVD was on. I think it was like a tenner or something like that. So I bought that, and that sort of reawakened it for me. But the DVDs, I must admit, I hadn't really been collecting them until I started writing for Celestial Toy Room. Mm-hmm. I sort of bought them bit by bit, brought a few Troughtons that I liked and a few Tom Baker and Davisons and all the rest of it. But I thought to myself, well, if I've got them on video, then I'll just wait until these things come down in price. Yeah. Being a freelance writer for 5 years until last April, I'd say. Meant that I could only really buy these things as and when, but slowly over time I did build up that collection. Now I've got them all. But it was a real slow burner. I can see the benefits now. The way you can really see it is in the location shoots, where they've really spruced them up. I mean, take something like, I've spoken about Davison a lot today, but something like Black Orchid. That location filming for the cricket match, if you compare that to how it looked on VHS, it's staggering now what they've done. And I do prefer the DVD versions as a consequence, because they look so good. But I think I've appreciated them more as an adult. I think as a teenager, I just felt like replenishing here and there. And in the end, I did get rid of my VHS collection. I've only kept maybe two or three, I reckon.
Yeah, were they sentimental ones for you, or?
I kept more than 30 years in the TARDIS for sentimental value. I kept the Hand of Fear for monetary value because that's such a rare one. And I've also kept, I think it's the Pertwee Years video, which of course does have the demons on there in black and white. But anyway, it's it was over time. But yes, there was a few years where I really didn't. Doctor Who just didn't do it for me, I'm afraid to say. And then, of course, when it came back in 2005, it awoke everything again, and especially the build-up to it, and, you know, those memories of, you know, being a kid, lying on the ground, you know, eating sweets and, you know, flicking through that yearbook and, you know, creating lists and,
yeah,
all came flooding back.
Oh, nice. Just while we're on the topic of DVDs, I've recently finished the set too. I was very slow in finishing it. Can you recall the final disc or discs you bought to finish your collection?
Ah.
Because I can tell you what mine was, because I've only just done it. And it was the Canine Tales box set. Of Canine and Company and the Invisible Enemy.
that was
the final discs I bought to finish.
I'd have to say, I mean, that I had a few missing, and I bought, I think it was Terror of the Zygons, which is one of my favourite all-time Doctor Who stories. The Underwater Menace, of course, and I think the other three... the third was... something like, I think it was Planet of Giants.
Ah, yeah.
Thinking about it. So, yeah, so it was just, it was, you know, like a Black Friday sale, basically.
Planet of Giants was towards the bottom of my list as well, I must say.
Yeah, yeah. It was canny of To Entertain to leave Terror of the Zygons until one of the very last, considering the reputation that it's got of being, you know, such a classic story. But the other two, could have taken or left, really. What did you think, actually, about the Underwater Menace reconstructions?
Oh, could have been better. I mean, but you're not dealing with great source material to begin with. So, you know, I wasn't expecting a whole lot going into it. I mean, they could have recreated it with Disney-quality CGI and in colour, and it probably wouldn't have helped a whole lot. So, you know, to me, it is what it is. It's an artifact. It helps you get a sense of the story, but it's never going to be in my top 10 or 20 or 30 or 40.
100.
Yeah. Okay, let's move into some more generic questions, because I think we've got a good feel for how you've come to the series and you've had your wilderness years, and I must admit I had some too when I hit about my mid-teens. I think we all do to some degree.
Yeah.
What Doctor did you first gravitate towards, and has that stayed the same or has that changed over time?
I reckon it's probably changed over time, I reckon. I mean, because my mum was such a big fan of his, I think she tended to buy me the Pertwee stories more. And because John Pertwee, like I said, you know, knew him as Wurzel Gummidge, you already felt safe in his company because he was already a face who you recognised. But actually, someone who grabbed me very early on and is still to this day my favourite Doctor is Patrick Troughton. He's the naughty uncle. You know, he's the man who could stand at the back of, you know, a crowded room, but your eyes would still gravitate towards him. And you can see the cogs whirring in his mind. You know, he might be acting the buffoon, but actually he's the most dangerous and, you know, devastatingly brilliant man in, you know, there. Yeah. It's the rapport between him and Jamie as well. And these little fragments that I had, I mean, actually J.R. Southall once said to me that he thought that I probably saw Patrick Troughton as the Wizard of Oz because he's not quite there. You know, he's that myth. He's the one who, you know, unfortunately still has so many missing episodes. So he's that person who, you know, that you've seen bits of and you want to see more, but you can't, you know, or you've heard of. And back then, I mean, I had... like I said, I had the Troughton years and I had Cybermen in the early years, the Ice Warriors box set as well, which I loved. I think were probably... oh, and The Invasion, actually. Yeah, The Invasion as well. I think they were probably the only four Troughton stories I had, but DWM back then used to run a thing called the Telesnap Archive.
Yeah.
So I used to cut those pages out and put them in ring binders, which I've probably still got somewhere, actually. But I used to put them in ring binders, so I could flick through and I could actually, you know, look and read through stuff like The Evil of the Daleks and The Enemy of the World and really get more of a feel. But Patrick Troughton always felt like a safe pair of hands. And I just think he struck that balance brilliantly between funny, sad, happy, you know, scary as well, actually, in some cases. That scene in the moon base, right towards the end, when he's saying, "Oh, you know, did you search? You said you searched the whole base, every nook and cranny." He goes, "Did your men search in here?" And
yeah.
All that kind of stuff. And then, oh, hang on a minute, like, oh dear.
Great character actor.
Fantastic. Yes. Oh, brilliant, brilliant. And actually, I still think probably the best actor to play the Doctor, in my opinion. But I mean, the other one, I mean, I loved, once again, felt like a naughty uncle, was Tom Baker.
Yeah.
I think those two were the ones who I loved the most. I mean, Peter Day, I think probably Doctors 2 through to 5 were the ones that I liked the most. Mm. I always felt there was a bit more of continuity when it came to people like Baker and Davison, because I'd get the videos that it would be a story that followed a story. So I'd get something like Revenge of the Cybermen, then Zygons, then Planet of Evil, and you know, something like Resurrection, Planet Fire, and Caves of Androzani, that kind of thing. So then you had a bit of continuation there. Pertwee and Troughton were a bit more fragmented, but I think early on I liked Pertwee, but I really, as soon as I saw more Troughton, I thought, no, this guy, yeah, like you said, he's the governor.
Yeah. Does picking Troughton in that role also inform where your favourite companion comes from? Is it from his era, or do you just go really left field when it comes to favourite companion?
No, not at all. I think it's definitely Jamie.
Right.
I think it boils down to the fact that they were just so good together on screen. They're so telepathic. You know, they know what one another's thinking on screen. Troughton and Hines, you know, and it makes for a fantastic duo. I think even though you've got Zoe and Victoria there, you could really, you know, you could watch Doctor and Jamie all day. You know, there wouldn't need to be a third companion there. They're just so good. I really liked Sarah Jane Smith as well, and I really liked Harry Sullivan as well. I used to bemoan the fact that, you know, he starred in so few stories. I really would have loved to have seen, you know, more Fourth Doctor, Sarah and Harry. I think they were probably, you know, I think those two Doctors and those two TARDIS teams that I just mentioned are probably to this day still my favourite, I'd have to say. I think Matt Smith and Karen Gillan and Arthur Darvill are a close third. Mm-hmm. But I think those two are the top brackets. And they're just, you know, I remember actually watching Zygons for the first time, and you've seen the oil rig explode, you know, after the Scarrisons attacked it. And then it just switches to, you know, Tom Baker and, you know, Liz Sladen and Ian Martyr walking through that bush, and Tom Baker's wearing, you know, the Scottish Highland stuff, and Sarah Jane Smith's wearing his hat, and Harry's wearing his scarf, and you just think, and I just remember smiling, thinking, oh, okay. No, and that music as well is just lovely, lovely music, a landing in Scotland, I love that. So yeah, I mean, I suppose the companions that I really adore have been informed, I suppose, by the Doctors that they were with, but they're just so good.
Yeah, yeah. All right, look, to round things out here, what would your advice be for someone, young or old, could be someone who's old but never watched the classic era, and they want to dip their toe in it? Where would you advise they start? I guess there's no right or wrong answer here, but where would you advise they start?
I think if you watch the new series and you like, let's say, an alien or a monster, then I'd go back and see just how they started out in the classic series. So if you like, let's say, the Silurians, for example, then go and start with Doctor Who and the Silurians. If you like the Autons, then start with Spearhead from Space. If you like the Daleks, go back and watch Genesis. You know, the Cybermen, I would probably say for them, Earthshock. You know, find something which you can. I wouldn't actually, John, I wouldn't advise going back and watching the black and whites, because I know for my generation, there's still a little bit of stigma about black and white. My girlfriend really doesn't like it. Watching anything in black and white, it's just it seems to be for that tail end of Generation X, just see it as being old and a little bit naff because it's not in colour. So I would say start with something colourful, start with something, you know, Pertwee or Baker era, and start with something that you already know, but go and seek out the origins.
Interesting.
And see how that character or that race developed.
You see, if I was asking myself that question, if someone liked Daleks perhaps, I might send them back to, say, Remembrance.
Or Remembrance, yeah.
You know?
Well, I was thinking, because of The Witch's Apprentice and the... What was it? It was the... you'd have to cut that bit out. The Magician's Apprentice and the Witch's Familiar. Because you had Davros there, the origin of him in that story. It now works as a counterplot for Genesis, because you've got the Genesis of the Daleks, obviously, in that story, but also Davros as the complete, Davros in his prime, coming up with those creations. So those two can kind of pivot. So I the reason why I went for Genesis was because it links in with a very, recent episode. But Remembrance is brilliant as well. So I've got no quarrel with that.
Yeah, I mean the McCoy era got slagged at the time and still gets slagged by some people now, but it has that slightly more modern sort of sensibility about it that can sometimes just bridge things a bit for a fan. I feel, the further you go back in Doctor Who, it's very much like they're acting a play and there's just someone sitting up in the TV centre, flicking between cameras as they just act out a play. Whereas, something like Remembrance has a bit more of a modern feel to it. When you get to something like Survival in the McCoy era, it's urban. He's walking down a street. He's in a little shop. He's feeding a cat. It's almost a prototype for New Who.
Yeah, and actually, Sylvester McCoy, Sophie Aldred, that the whole sort of Andrew Cartmell era, its reputation has improved so much because it is that bridge.
Mm.
I mean, back in the day when I was a kid, Sylvester McCoy was seen as being the worst Doctor. I suppose that went hand in hand with the fact that, the show had been cancelled under his tenure. But actually now you've got a lot of children. I know because my sister, is now, nearly 16. And some of her friends have watched the McCoy era and love Ace.
Yeah.
And they see a Doctor who, this little man with the umbrella, this intriguing entity, walks down the urban street and looks slightly out of place but can own it. I think that McCoy era has definitely got better. It's like a fine wine. That has got better with age.
Definitely has. All right. Now, where can people find you online? We've mentioned the Diddly Dum podcast, but where can people find that and where else can they find you if they want to hunt out some more Hayden?
Okay, you can find us at Diddly Dum on Twitter, and you can find us at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, and at Facebook, just type in Diddly Dum in the search engine and you'll find us there. And also, you can find me at www.haydengribble.co.uk. I've also got an author page on Facebook, which is just facebook.com/HaydenGribbleAuthor, and also soundcloud.com/HaydenGribble, where you can find Doctor Who's short story, which I wrote.
Brilliant.
And there's a few other sort of Doctor Who projects coming up very soon, so I'll have to keep you noted.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the show and helping me understand how a young person gets into the classic era. It's been eating away at me for a few months now.
Absolutely fine. Anytime. I'm just worried about your phone tariff now.
Oh, I'll figure something out. I'll figure something out. Thank you again, Hayden. Cheers.
No problem. Thank you.
The A to Z of Doctor Who, Part 2, B. Baker, Colin. Regular winner of the DWM Who's Your 12th Favourite Actor to Play the Doctor poll, Colin Baker played the sixth incarnation of the Time Lord for around 3 weeks in the middle of the 1980s, in between Peter Davison and someone McCoy. Seabake's unique shtick was pouting, preening camp arrogance, combined with unshakable belief in his own intellectual superiority. This is a tricky intellectual posture to pull off when dressed as a total bloody idiot, as any university student can attest. His brief era started badly with The Twin Dilemma, often voted the worst Doctor Who story ever, although the Target novel was rather good. And then his first full season in the role, which featured Daleks, Cybermen, the Master, the Sontarans, and the Second Doctor and Jamie, still made fans feel it was all too new and too much of a departure. Season 22 consisted of Saturday Tea Time episodes of 45 minutes duration. The BBC decided this format would never work. Just think about that for a second. And the show went on a hiatus of 18 months so that the BBC could divert the £17.50 they would have spent on making a new series of Doctor Who towards a new production, Breakfast Television, which had no aliens in it at all, with the possible exception of Frank Boff. Colin's main companion was Perry Brown, portrayed by Nicola Bryant, although someone thought it would be a good idea to replace her with Bonnie Langford, who could squeam in the key of F. Throughout this era, the two big reasons for watching were Nicola Bryant, and once she left the show, the writing was on the wall. Baker himself only lasted another 6 episodes, and his fiery, incandescent Sixth Doctor bowed out in a blaze of glory when he banged his head on the TARDIS console. No, really. No, really. Baker has gone on to win hearts and minds with his more measured and likeable take on the Sixth Doctor in the Big Finish audios, which are not canon. Baker, Pip and Jane. Everyone loves it when British novelist Will Self ejaculates his elevated linguistic gallimaufry of sesquipedalian circumlocution. People lap it up, but in the 80s, if you tried to slip a bit of fancy wordage into Doctor Who scripts, you'd get castigated on live television by a specky teenaged Chris Chibnall before you could say catharsis of spurious morality. These two writers, Pip and Jane Baker, gave us the Rani, the Vervoids, and an emergency ending to the Trial of a Time Lord, which 30 years later continues to divide fandom into two camps, those who think it was irredeemable excrement, and me. Baker, Tom. To fans even older than me, T-Bakes is the best and definitive Doctor Who, an electrifying and utterly alien presence who dominated the screen during his 7-year tenure. But to me, as a small kid, he was just a terrifying, goggly-eyed, shouty drunk man, and his trip to the Pharos Project couldn't have come soon enough. We're lucky that fandom is a broad church, welcoming of differing views and opinions, or else I'd be worried about sharing attitudes like that with you, as to some, they may seem controversial, not to say heretical. Ian Levine has just set my legs on fire. The best introduction to the genius of Tom's Fourth Doctor, which in later life I have come to appreciate, is to sit down and watch City of Death, because to me it's his finest hour. Tom, no doubt, won't remember a bloody thing about it. BBC Wales. Just near Belgium lies the small European country of Wales. In 2003, their hilariously named main broadcaster, BBC Wales, suggested the idea of a Saturday Tea Time family drama about a crotchety man travelling through time and space in a police box, which was bigger on the inside than the outside, fighting Daleks. Totally unaware that our own proper London BBC had already had the same idea 40 years previously. For a laugh, we let them go ahead with their funny little remake, which was ultimately a bit embarrassing when it proved to be almost 16 times better than the proper classic series, maybe apart from Series 4 and the specials, which were awful. Beryl Reid. A doyen of the British stage who, on being offered a part in the show during the Peter Davison era, researched extensively for her performance in Earthshock by watching a few tapes of old Tom Baker serials, and assumed that everyone was supposed to be drunk the whole time. Big Finish. Take a listen to this. That is what canon sounds like. Big Question. If and when Chris Chibnall decides to call it a day, who else is there to take over the show? Not Gatiss. Anyone but Gatiss. Billy Fluff. A Billy Fluff is fandom's affectionate term for any line of dialogue mangled or snapped by the actor William Hartnell, who often struggled to remember long, complex scientific explanations, or short exchanges of dialogue, or the name of the planet they were on, or the names of his companions. What's genuinely shocking is that only 50-odd years ago, you could get away with this on a television show, getting huge audiences. Nowadays, television is a much more professional enterprise, and people retake scenes if an actor fluffs his lines and says, I don't know, metabolis instead of metabilis, or accidentally comes out with the word shaboogans. Blood Heat. People rave about the BBC novel Interference from 1999, a two-part event publication in which the TARDIS visits a planet called Dust, where the Third Doctor is killed in a different way to that which we saw happen on the telly, thus massively altering the Doctor's timeline. In Blood Heat, however, a 1993 Virgin New Adventure novel by Jim Mortimer, the TARDIS lands in an alternate timeline in which the Third Doctor was killed in a different way to that which we saw happen on the telly, thus massively altering the universe's timeline. So suddenly, Lawrence Miles doesn't look like such a genius, does he, EDA fans?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's the Letter Lords.
That was the worst evil, sinister laugh ever.
Having a stroke?
Well, was I? No, it was hot. I was trying to do like a spooky atmospheric laugh, and that right. Didn't work out, unfortunately, Jim.
Transylvanian Letter Lords.
Yeah, the Letter Lords. Like that. But yeah, it didn't work. Hello, I'm Bob Fleming from Prog 2 Podcast.
Yes, and I'm Jim Cameron from the Crinoid Podcast, and we are the Letter Lords.
Yeah, together we are the Letter Lords on the Doctor Who Show podcast, which went on its inaugural voyage a couple of weeks ago, end of last month, and it came out brilliantly well, I thought, Jim.
It certainly did.
From everyone, obviously, not just us, you know, but everyone.
I think we let the side down.
But I think everything came together brilliantly. I love that fanzine sort of format. It was great. So good work, everyone. And I hope the listeners enjoyed it too, obviously, as well. That's the whole point we do it for.
Yes, good downloads and everything. So thanks for listening if you're back again. And if you're not, then go back and listen to the first one. That's an order.
Yeah. And to explain, if you missed the first one, what we're here to do, the Letter Lords, me and Jim, we basically are reading out letters sent into the official Doctor Who magazine, Doctor Who Monthly magazine, into the Galaxy Forum. And we've picked out one or two that we thought were quite interesting and worth talking about.
That is absolutely correct, yes. Excellent. And this month we are, let me just check, this is happening live, listeners. I'm looking at the spine of the latest Doctor Who magazine, 496.
Yeah.
That's what we're looking at today, keeping it real for you.
Magazine 496, facts there for you, ladies and gentlemen, facts. and it's sort of off the back end of the Christmas special, to which there's a full page of gushing reviews about said Christmas special. By people who obviously have not watched the Christmas special. Unbelievable. But from this section, we're going to read the voice of sanity. It's a young girl called Eleanor Clark, who sent this in by email. Do you want to take this one on, Jim?
Yeah, okay, yeah, Eleanor Clark, 12 years of age.
Yes, and this is the point of this one, it's ace.
Yes, so I quote Eleanor, she says, I would like to take this opportunity to thank Jenna Coleman, Peter Capaldi and the whole of this year's Doctor Who team for making the 2015 run one of the best of all time. That said, I was extremely disappointed with the Christmas special. I think it lacked conviction in the plot itself, and what little real danger that was faced was undermined, and the point was missed entirely. I think that Riversong has had her day, and quite frankly, I was bored at the time, let alone now. I really thought we'd finally got away from all that. I would like to ask that we no longer have Christmas specials as insignificant bridges between stories and that we bring the same quality the series has to the festive season. Ouch.
Hear, hear. And I think what I particularly like about this letter is it is from a 12-year-old person, 12-year-old girl. And I'm saying that because obviously last series or season got criticised heavily for its more adult content, more confusing plot lines and all that kind of stuff. So you'd expect a 12-year-old, if you like, to enjoy the Christmas, the stupid, silly Christmas episode than you would do a full-on series of serious Doctor Who. And that was, I think, a concern for a lot of people that, you know, do what we do, the sort of review shows and bits like that, that are young people tuning out. And it's nice to sort of look at that and think, actually, kids are still clever. It's reassuring, Jim.
It is reassuring, yeah. And it kind of shows that you don't have to dumb down the Christmas specials. You know, it's for a wider family audience and certainly more casual. You get people who tune in at Christmas, you know, because they can't get out of their seats anymore that day.
Too much turkey.
Yeah, too much turkey and chocolates and stuff. So, you know, they'll sit through a Doctor Who and they might not watch any of the previous series or the one after that. So do we really need to dumb down a Christmas special if 12-year-olds are finding it, you know, too silly for them?
No, well, I find it quite brilliant and reassuring that pretty much, you know, this young lady's in the same mindset as us old Doctor Who fans, if you see what I mean.
Quite.
I think it was quite a talking point, shall we say, Series 9 for Doctor Who fans. But it was overall very clever, very brilliant. New ideas were pushed in there that we'd not really seen before, not seen explored in the way they were. And then we had a very stupid, dumbed down Christmas adventure, which has been, you know, shown for what it is by a young person, that it is stupid and they get it. So that's reassuring to know.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I was much younger than Eleanor Clark when Hinchcliffe was being shown. You know, the Hinchcliffe era was being shown first time round, and that wasn't silly, and you know, I absolutely loved it. And in fact, you know, when the Doctor Who started to get silly with towards the end of Tom Baker, I noticed then. And I thought, this isn't as good as it used to be. It's too silly. So I think kids are underestimated, aren't they?
Yeah.
Constantly by TV. And this is another case if that was the market they're aiming for.
I think it's maybe more us, isn't it? Worrying that it's too clever for us. Maybe or something. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Rather than, yeah, you know, it's for kids. Yeah, dumb it down for kids. Not for us. Not for us. We get it, you know, because we're older and got three fans. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Ever so clever, yeah, aren't we?
But yeah, have you got any more points you'd like to make on that one, Jim?
Only that things like the farting Slitheens and belching wheelie bins and stuff was a kind of misstep in Series 1, isn't it? You know, kids don't need that to enjoy a programme. And I'm not too sure this one is aimed at kids as such, because it was more of a kind of romantic comedy. But, you know, some of the sillier jokes probably were aimed at kids. Or
I think the more fun aspects of it, the more romp, you know, that was maybe what people think that would be aimed at kids. But it's nice to see that a 12-year-old got Series 9 and didn't enjoy the Christmas adventure like us. So it's good to know. Next one. This is a one from a gentleman called Chris Wardell. It's an email. And it's 5 points, which are kind of covered throughout the rest of it, which go into a bit more depth with quite lengthy letters. But I'll read out these points and then we can discuss them one by one, Jim, I reckon. Okay. So this is Chris. Here are my 5 thoughts on how Doctor Who can win back its place at the top of TV drama rating charts. 1, put it on at 7 p.m. and keep it in the same time slot every week. Now, I cannot concur more with this point. What's your thoughts on a regular time slot, Jim?
Well, it's vital, isn't it? You need to, particularly, you know, as early as 7 p.m. as well, or 6:45 or 7:15, whatever, but as long as it's that kind of area, and it's that kind of area every week, then, you know, the family who wants to watch all together can schedule the, you know, meals around it and all that kind of stuff and just make it appointment TV again, rather than, you know, having it too late for the younger kids so, you know, they can't see it until the following morning or whatever, or, you know, people have to go off maybe separately and watch it via their various screens in the house. Yeah. And, you know, it ceases to become a family event, doesn't it? So, definitely keep it on the same time every week and definitely keep it on around that time.
Definitely. Because, like, mum and dad go out, don't they, about half eight sometimes on a Saturday night as well. So it's kind of like any later than 7 o'clock, people are doing stuff. Any earlier, you know, they're doing stuff. It's kind of like it's a great time. And also, it's every show that's a long-running show is on at the same time. So Coronation Street, EastEnders, all these shows are on at 7:30 or 8 o'clock. You know they're on, and you know what time they're on. And it's reassuring that as well. And it also makes people organise and they can sit down. But the optimum time for Doctor Who now is 7 p.m. When it was at 5:25 or whatever, when it initially started, it worked well because after when we had football on telly, and obviously football was, you know, it was massively watched because you know, you could watch, like I say, football on telly, which we've not been able to do for ages unless you pay extortionate amounts of money for it. So it was keeping the you know, the adults entertained and the kids. And I think 7 o'clock now is that time slot. Because we live in a different world nowadays, you know. But yeah, I'm 100 million percent behind that, even though you can't get 100 million percent, it's 100%.
Yes, talking about footballers did that,
didn't you? Yeah, that's what they're saying. I'll give you 110% today. Well, you didn't, because you can't get more than 100%. Wayne Rooney,
they don't know, bless them. They don't know.
Do not know.
They go with their feet. That's enough. That's enough, you know.
The thing about the Arsenal, they try to walk it in the net. Now, if you bring that out about any football team in any conversation, even if you don't know very much about football, the blokes will turn around and go, yeah, yeah, you're right, mate. You're right. Any team, when someone's talking about a football team, just say, problem is with that team, they always try and walk it in, and you will get respect from said...
There you go, listeners.
From said football fans. I do it.
Blag your way through football conversations. The Bob Fleming way.
Number two. Basically, some male eye candy. Because he's touched on, isn't it, about in Robin Calvert's letter from Lancashire. Basically, we had pretty doctors, didn't we, in Matt Smith and David Tennant. So a lot of girls, women, fancy them. Obviously, it's not the case with Mr. Capaldi, because, you know, it's not their cup of tea. But obviously, the lads have got Jenna Louise Coleman. So the lasses don't have any eye candy. Or lads, do you know what I mean? So what's your thoughts on this, Jim?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, and I mean, it sounds kind of superficial, but, you know, this is a flagship show that's, you know, trying to reach the widest audience possible. And in the 70s and 60s, we always had something for the dads, didn't we?
For dads, I have to football after match of day.
Keep them watching, you know, with the scantily clad savage girls and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, the women perhaps weren't catered for so much with the Google-eyed Tom Baker, though I'm sure he has a huge sexual magnetism. I can't really judge. But I mean, this day and age, you know, there's no doubt that the part of the reason that Doctor Who took off so hugely under the RTD reign was that it was more populist. And part of that was fanciable doctors.
Yeah.
And yeah, and assistants. Yeah, yeah, something for everybody.
Yeah. Strictly Come Dancing, this is what Robin was saying as well, full of, you know, scantily clad attractive people. And it's probably a reason why it gets however many million views a week it does, all at the same time. Sex sells, 100%. Even in a geeky science fiction show.
Well, we've all got hormones, haven't we? No matter how geeky we are.
Exactly, Jim, exactly. But I think it's, I don't know, I think it's, yeah, getting the assistant or the doctor, I don't know. Because I know you mentioned before about when we spoke earlier about Capaldi and his thoughts on an attractive male young companion.
Yeah, he's gone on record, hasn't he, saying that he doesn't want a young male companion because he might get sort of stuck in a bath chair while the young male companion does all the exciting heroic stuff. So, yeah, I wouldn't expect to see a male companion while he's still a doctor, but, you know, with the Chibnall announcement, chances are he won't be the doctor for much longer, and Chibnall is likely to have pretty much a clean slate. He might have, if it's going to start in the spring, then the 7 p.m. time slot that we were talking about just a minute ago might be up for grabs on BBC One without too much competition opposite it. And, you know, Chris Chibnall might want to cast a younger doctor to try and claw back the people that were lost when Capaldi was cast.
Yeah, because you don't see, you know, posts of Capaldi like you did with David Tennant, particularly on females' walls, if you see what I mean. And males was. Do you know what I mean? He was that symbol. I know that, you know, female friends of mine really fancied David Tennant, which was a weird one because I know he came from Casanova, but he wasn't, obviously, Doctor Who rocketed him to places where he never expected to go, if you see what I mean, you know, fame-wise. And the big sex appeal that he got from that. I mean, I didn't really know him before, or you didn't really hear of him from so many people that, you know, we were attracted to him, basically. So, yeah, I think it's definitely something that they need to reconsider again, to bring back that sort, you know, the audience of females and males. We have no male eye candy apparently in Doctor Who currently, and they're quite right.
Well, you never know, it might be a female doctor and some male eye candy on her arm.
Jim, I've just given up a little bit of life then when you said that. I've said this before on other Doctor Who podcasts, and I'll say it here right now. And it's not me being sexist. I've had this argument with men and women, and usually it's women that back me up with this. Doctor Who is a man. He's a male figure and always will be. If Doctor Who became a woman, I would stop watching Doctor Who. That's bad because I've loved Doctor Who since I was really little. And it's quite a serious thing. And I got told off by men for that being sexist, but not by women. That was a strange thing. They concurred with me that you can't make Doctor Who a woman.
Well, that's perhaps a topic for another time, as there isn't actually a letter about this about that subject. But just to finish that little one off, I don't think the first thing Chibnall will do will be to cast a female Doctor. I think that would be madness.
Yeah. Yeah.
To start off his era. So if that happens, it won't be the only time soon, I don't think.
No, most definitely not. Number three, lose the continuity. Yes, we fans love it, but everyone loves a good story, whether it's riddled with continuity or not. Very good point. I like sort of continuity as a fan, but it doesn't need it, does it?
It doesn't really need it. And I do, I mean, I enjoy continuity as much as the next sort of rabid Doctor Who fan.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you kind of wonder if Chris Chibnall, you know, with a starting everything off, again, as kind of happens with a new showrunner and probably new Doctor, would he be brave enough just to shelve pretty much all continuity and just have the basic time traveler in a police box and take it from there? Maybe see it from someone else's point of view, a bit like Rose, you know, have someone who meets his character and, you know, you might get little bits of information sort of drip-fed, but not all this backstory, because it... Even with New Who, there's a whole ton of continuity just within those years.
A lot of baggage, and, didn't there? Yeah, I'm fit.
Yeah, it's beginning to feel a bit clogged, isn't it?
Yeah.
Already, yeah. But I'll add that to some of the continuity which they still use from the old show. It would be really exciting and quite refreshing if they just stripped it down to the bare minimum, which they pretty much did with Rose.
Yeah.
But little by little, it was kind of added on. And perhaps you have to do that to keep it interesting. I don't know, but... It would be interesting to see more of a reboot like that and make it really refreshing and a huge jumping on point for new viewers.
No, I do concur, Jim. I think the beauty of having a reset button, if you like, on is just back to a man in a box with an assistant. Because if you think about as a writer, it must be quite daunting but brilliant at the same time that you can go anywhere in time. So anyway, in time, future, not been written yet, has it? Obviously, the past, you've got something, documents that you can use to develop any historicals or whatever. But you can go anywhere in space and make up your own world. You can basically do anything as a writer, which, like I say, is quite daunting and brilliant. But to have that device, you don't need all the baggage. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, and despite the extremely wide brief that the show has, you know, wider than anything else, it does tend to fall into formulas, doesn't it?
Yeah.
With each showrunner, and you know, particularly the older series, but even now, it's slipped into its own kind of formula. If you could just sort of bust through that completely, and just, I don't know, treat each new story as a blank slate.
Yeah,
think how much fun you could have with that.
Yeah, I think that's it's something I'd like to see, because I think they've tried a lot already in New Who, and it'd be nice to see that sort of back to basics. Off we go, a different adventure every week, you know, without even having an arc. Just have a big, awesome, huge, big adventure finale that you can jump on at any point. I think it'd be good to try that. I think it'd be nice to try that.
Yeah, I mean, you could write it into the fiction that somehow maybe even the Doctor's forgotten all his past.
Mm.
And if you find that it absolutely bombs, and perhaps you can revert to type the following season if you've still got anyone still watching. But it's risky, I suppose. But if you're aiming to get new viewers, because we're going to watch anyway, aren't we?
Yeah, of course.
And people who are on board, you know, not necessarily to the extent that we are, but people who are on board and you know, will watch it most weeks, you know, will be as interested as we are, I think, in that. But it'd be a huge opportunity to get new people on.
Definitely. I do think, yeah, it's definitely worth to look at, you know, having a go at it. I think the funny thing is, though, don't blame me and Jim if that does happen, yeah? We don't have that.
Well, we are very influential.
Right, point four from Chris. Keep this more accessible, friendlier 12th Doctor, which we saw, you know, in season 9, and I think he was better for it.
Yeah, I mean, I never had a problem with him.
No, I didn't either.
Being grumpy, I thought it was quite fun. And I think kids think that's quite fun to see this older person being rude to people, being, you know, perhaps quite petulant and childish. So I don't think it's as huge a problem as has been made. I think the age issue was more of an issue with some people. I think you'd have still lost viewers if he'd been super friendly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think he's more interesting. We've had two sort of bouncy puppy dog doctors, haven't we? I think it was required. I think it works well. And I think it works better than those I mean, Tennant was a very human doctor. Matt Smith was an eccentric human doctor, I suppose.
Yeah.
And Capaldi's got his humanity. He's just not super approachable, and there's no reason he should be. He's this ancient alien.
No, I agree. I think when he sort of softened up a little last season, I loved him from the get-go, really. I loved it was Doctor Who, or the Doctor was taking himself seriously again. But I think, yeah, I've really warmed to him. I've liked that when he's introduced a bit more compassion, because I think the Doctor, of all things, you know, he's a compassionate individual. So it's nice that it was only drip-fed. It wasn't gushing, which it has been with previous new Doctors. It was just, it's more of a treat, and it's more deserved that compassion, I think, from Capaldi than it would be from the previous Doctors. Maybe not Eccleston so much, but Tennant and Smith. And I think it's more right for the character as well.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think it's probably true that the Series 9 Doctor is a better mix.
Yeah.
I enjoyed him in Series 8, but this is a better Doctor. He's a more recognisable Doctor as well, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the big compassionate speeches and stuff in the Zygon version, things like that. I think they've hit the sweet spot, really, with this Doctor's character. And I think, I think it should continue, like Chris says.
Yeah, no, I concur. And his final point, and I could not agree any more with his point five, keep people dead. If everyone comes back alive next week, where's the drama, tension, or the peril? Yeah, 100%, a million 100% agree.
Well, think how much more powerful the end of the Raven episode, Face the Raven, how much more powerful that would have been if we hadn't all thought, well, we're bound to see her again this series, which I think everyone thought, didn't they?
Yeah.
That would have been super powerful.
Massively.
But it wasn't, and it's the show's fault because it keeps bringing people back, no one dies properly. If you have to keep bringing people back from the dead, don't kill them in the first place.
Yeah.
There are other forms of peril, you'd be trapped somewhere or whatever, kept prisoner and stuff. To have them keep dying but coming back just takes the impact out of it.
It's definitely become tiresome after 10 years, because obviously we had it with Rose to a degree. I know she was trapped in a parallel universe, but in essence, she was dead. It was quite sad. But then she came back into the normal universe quite easily. Obviously, Amy and Rory. Now, I quite like that. It was quite romantic, the way they went back. They actually did die. Do you see what I mean? Through the angels. That was it was beautiful in a way, because they went back and they had a happy life anyway. But it just feels like there's no severity. They're not actually going to die, and it's going to be a shock like it was with Adric, celebration / shock, like it was with Adric. Do you see him? Or Katrina as well. I know she was only in it for the Mythmakers and the first four or five episodes of Dalek Master Plan, but it was still like she was dead. And I think this one with Clara, it would have been so much better. And I'm not knocking, it's not because of, me wanting to see Clara leave or, generally comes and acts, because I think she'd be brilliant. But it would have just been, wow, right, Doctor, you're serious now. If you die, you die. It's like River Song, everyone just seems to get a weird get-out clause.
Yeah, well, it's not just the deaths, really. It's just everyone has about 17 leaving scenes.
It's like Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Yeah, it's law of diminishing returns, isn't it? The more leaving scenes you have, the less effect each one is.
Yeah.
And you're just absolutely flogging this dead horse. So, I think what will happen in the final, well, we keep saying the final Capaldi season, but certainly the final Moffat season, there will probably be one companion that lasts for that year. And perhaps maybe straddles the two Doctors, so to speak. But, the chances are, if there's going to be a clean slate for Chris Chibnall, which there probably will be, then this is going to be a fairly short-lived companion. And I don't see why we have to have companions for so long.
No.
Just a year is enough, I think, generally speaking. Two, if you want to develop the character a bit more and you've got some more story to tell. But to be honest, I think, much so like Clara as a companion, I think she's the best one in New Who. She did outstay her welcome.
Yeah, it's how you refresh the show, isn't it? And obviously you do that, the Doctor, with a new production team, new writer, new writers, new directors, and a new assistant. And Clara's lasted a long time. And I think it was quite good she did, because I think this was the finest series of Doctor Who, Series 9. So it was nice that she went, well, didn't go out, or did go out, whatever, on a really strong full series, that wasn't overly confusing as well. It was more just straight companion Doctor Who. But and also, you won't want everyone to die every week because then it's a bit scary, isn't it?
Tell you what, that'd be good. Well, again, you lose the impact, yeah. Don't you?
Have an assistant every week that dies at the end. Imagine that. But who killed Kenny off South Park? Who killed Doctor Who's assistant this week? But it does need to have more impact to death than thinking, oh, well, they're going to come back next week or the week after, maybe. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and there's so many times that in Moffat era in particular, you know, someone will die that week and come back that week, you know.
Yeah.
It was just got silly.
And it's also quite silly sometimes how they come back as well. Mm. You know, it's kind of like, oh, God, really? Really? Because that's what put me off the last episode, even though I love it all now. The sort of finale of the last series was the starting scene, there's Clara. You're like, what? Well, I thought she was dead. At least you could have, you know what I mean, give us a bit of something, give us a bit more anticipation. But there she was straight away. It's like, oh, God, here we go again. Yeah, so it's a bit. It has been a bit deflating.
Yeah, it has been a bit. Mm. So, this is one of the things about, Moffat might want to do something completely different in his final year, and there's no doubt Chris Chibnall will want to do something different again when he starts. So, you know, maybe this sort of cycle will finish, maybe sooner rather than later. I don't know. We'll have to see, but... I think there are lessons to be learned here because I don't know what the general public thought of Clara's supposed death, Face of Raven, but you know, anyone who'd watched the show for any length of time will not have felt an awful lot of impact, I don't think, because you just assume she'd be coming back. So yeah. Dramatically, that is a problem.
Very much so. So, yeah, keep them dead, said the cheery letter lords.
Kill everyone. Well, let's put that one to bed. Yeah, we've got... a final tweet. I think this is from Blaine Coughlin. Mm. I'd really love to see a run where the outgoing and incoming companions overlap for about 4 or 5 episodes. Well, that would be a bit unusual.
Would be. And something that we have seen in Doctor Who in the past, and in New Who, obviously Rose, seen over 2 Doctors.
Yeah, but this is about overlapping companions so particularly, isn't it? One companion staying for a while the new one beds in and then going... once they bedded in, sort of thing. It's like with Ben and Polly, they stuck around for a bit, and then when Jamie was introduced, and then they left, and Jamie stayed on. And it's the same with what happened at the beginning of Davison, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, so I think I sort of misread that a little, and companions clashing over. Mm.
So you got Nyssa and Adric and Tegan, they kind of joined one by one and left one by one. And we haven't really seen a lot of that in the new series, if at all, have we? So...
no.
I think anything that rings a change with the companions is a good idea, and I don't say we should go back to the crowded TARDIS that we had with Davis, because it was a bit difficult for writers to give everyone something to do, wasn't it? But I think a Doctor and 2 companions is fine, and if that's an overlap of 2 single companions, then that's great, because they pair up for a few episodes, and then it's back to single companion again. Yeah, I'll be all for that, I think.
And also, I think it adds to the dynamic of the duo, if you like. So if there's, you know, 2 of them kicking around and a third pair, which is what I quite liked about Adam, even though I didn't like Adam, the character Adam from the end game and Dalek, I quite like the way he changed the dynamic.
Yes, he did, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, that was potential new clever cocky companion coming on board. And like with Captain Jack as well, to a degree, obviously he came more of a mainstay. But I like that when a third unknown is added into the equation, and that would work in that sort of vein really as well.
Yeah, I think that would work very well. We'll just find one final one here, a quickie. It's another tweet from Mike J. Lord. Am I the only fan who finds the Feast of Stephen genuinely funny? Yes, you are, Mike.
is that something to do with the Christmas special?
No, the Feast of Stephen, the old Christmas special.
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, the when he says an American Christmas, everyone. Is that the villain?
Yeah, from the Daleks' Master Plan. Yeah, not funny in the slightest.
Yeah. I didn't realize it was called the Feast of Stephen, wasn't it?
Yeah, a pun in itself. Stephen Taylor was on board at the time. Yes, you are alone in that. I don't know anyone else who found that funny.
But bless you, though, for trying.
Hmm.
You probably enjoyed the Christmas special this year.
There you go. There's something for everyone.
Not us.
Us old curmudgeons, you can't please us.
Yeah, bitter old little lords as we are. But again, it's been a pleasure, Jim, conversating with you again.
Yes, I enjoyed our conversating very much, and I hope you did at home.
Yeah, so I've been Bob Fleming from Prog to Who.
And I've been Jim Cameron from Crewnow Podcast, and we'll talk to you next month.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Welcome to Hooteek's Roadshow, our second instalment, and today I'm sitting down with David Kitchen. David, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. Now, I think some people out there listening to this podcast will know you as a long-time letter writer to many podcasts around the around the globe.
Yes.
Where else might people know you from?
Well, locals in Melbourne will probably know me from the fandom scene down here. I was on the committee in the local fan club back in the 90s, then had a break, and I came back as the president for 18 months leading up to the 50th anniversary. So in my local circles, I've been around for quite a while, but now that podcasts are making fandom truly international, I get my name out there and my opinions out there with a few letters here and there.
A few. I think there's not a week that goes by where I don't hear a podcast with one of your letters in.
We must listen to the same podcast then, because I don't send that many, but that's very kind of you.
I think we might. I think we might, especially your Diddly Dums and your Blue Boxes and so on.
And of course, 42 to Doomsday, which I've actually appeared on a couple of times. I've been friends with Rob and Mark for, well, a couple of decades now, so yeah, yes. I was very happy to be on their podcast a couple of times.
Absolutely, as fellow Melburnians.
Absolutely, yes.
Okie doke. Now, I've got the advantage of having you on video today, which the people at home don't have, and I dare say you've probably got something there to show me. What have you got there to show me for Hooteek's Roadshow?
Well, yes, when you very kindly asked me to take part in this segment, I thought, what am I going to show them? And I thought, what's the item that when people come to visit or fans, I show them, they go, that's a really nice thing to have. And so what I've selected is a copy of the book Time Frame from 1993, not just because it's a really nice piece of merchandise and a really nice book, but because inside I've actually got the signatures of four Doctors, 14 Companions, and Terence Dix. So this has been a bit of my my record of my time in fandom, my sort of memories of all the different stars I've met. So very special to me, and yeah, 19 signatures, all of which I've got in person.
Wow. Well, let's start with the book itself. I mean, we've got a lot to cover here, but we'll start with the book itself. You said it's the 93 version, so is that the hardcover you've got there?
It's the hardcover, yes. The one that was brought out as part of the 30th anniversary celebration so long ago now.
And I believe the year after, I think August of the year after, they did a soft cover version as well.
That sounds right, yes, definitely.
Okay, so take us through the book. Tell us what the book is and what's inside it.
So the book, I think it stands out as a piece of merchandise because although at that stage we had a number of books that looked very good, all of the particularly the hardcover format books were about information and reference, whereas this book is just a very gorgeous celebration, and it's about being a gorgeous piece of work. And if you go through, it's got a couple of pages on every season of the show from the first season up until about the middle range of the New Adventures, which were coming out around 93. And it's got full page pieces of artwork, recreations of Target covers and unused covers. And it's also got photographs. It's got little pieces of magic moments with photos of what the authors, House Amazon and Walker, have chosen as being really special moments. So it's just about really celebrating that 30 years of Doctor Who as we had at the time and all those gorgeous little parts about it. It's a book designed just to look nice.
Absolutely. I mean, there is text in the book, but whenever I think of this book on my shelf and think, well, I pull it down, I'm thinking of that because I want to look at pictures. I want
yes.
to look at artwork and things.
Absolutely, yes. It's a very, very beautiful book, and I think it showed a certain maturity of the fandom scene at that stage where people were willing to pay a little bit more and have really nice pieces of work that actually, you know, looked good on the shelf and they weren't just desperate for information. We had the Haney books, which were, you know, at a time without the internet and other books, they were really nice reference pieces, but this is just fandom celebrating the show in a really nice way. It's a really special book, I think.
And for newer fans of the show, people have come in with New Who, I think a lot of promotional material, a lot of material that's generated around the show now, DVD covers, whatever, it's not done in the same sort of artwork style. It's more photographic these days. This is almost a lost kind of style, almost.
I agree. I really miss the old artwork, whether it's the Christian Kilios stuff early on. Alistair Pearson did some absolutely lovely VHS covers, and I really miss that. The same with the Blake 7 VHS range. I kept several of those because I just really like those wonderful artwork covers. And yeah, I think we miss that now with computer generated and photos. And yep, I get it, they're a lot cheaper than commissioning someone to do a full size painting, but gee, they were nice.
Yeah, they're iconic in a way that I know pictures can be iconic. There are many famous iconic pictures in the world, but sure. with Doctor Who, growing up as a kid and looking at some of the Achilleos artwork, as you've already mentioned, and others, Andrew Skilleter, for example, there was just a magic about them because it wasn't a photograph. It was something from someone's mind, their imagination. There were sometimes things drawn into the pictures and you think, oh, what's that? And you could really think and really imagine, and in a way that you don't when you just look at a publicity photo of Peter Capaldi with his hand out like he's John Pertwee.
Absolutely. I'm just looking now at the recreation, full A4 page recreation of Andrew Skilleter's cover for the Caves of Androzani target book. And that's a really beautiful piece of work. And it's got the Sharrow's Jet painting. It's got the I think it's a sun or it's Davison Regenerator or a bit of both. I'm not sure. But it's a really memorable cover. And there's so many of those. That is, yeah, it's nice to see them recreated here without the titles and the text over the top, just as a piece of artwork.
Absolutely. Now, did you pick this book up as it came out or in years later?
I was given it as a Christmas present in 1993. So this would have been, you know, my parents would have said to me, what do you want for Christmas this year? I was 13 at the time. And this would have been the piece of merchandise that was slightly outside of pocket money range. Mm-hmm. And so it went on the Christmas list. And so I got it at the end of 93.
And do you have memories of that year, you know, eschewing lunch and they're saying, come on, David, come and have lunch. And you're saying, no, I'm reading this book.
Look, I think definitely that would have been the first thing I went to the room and opened up and started going through page after page. Absolutely. It was a really nice thing to have. And, you know, it was something that I wouldn't have been able to afford as a 13-year-old on pocket money. So it was a really nice little present to get.
All right. Now, you mentioned having so many autographs in the book, and you held it up for me. That's certainly an impressive number. Where have these come from? Are they all Australian conventions, or have you travelled further afield to get some of these?
No, they're all Australian conventions, which makes them, I think, particularly special for me. I know that UK fans and to some extent American fans are able to go to these really large conventions and, you know, see hundreds of shift stars all at once, but in Australia, particularly when you go back to the 90s, getting a star from the Doctor Who out to Australia was a big deal and a big undertaking. And so these are all people who have come to Australia, and I've seen them in Melbourne. And on several occasions, we made trips to Sydney. In fact, when we first started going up to Sydney in the 90s, we were all either students or newly in work, you know, in our teens and 20s. So we actually caught the overnight train to and from Sydney. And unless you've actually done the 13-hour overnight train from Melbourne to Sydney and back in a weekend, you just don't know what suffering is.
Yeah, that would be pretty grim, I think. Yeah, I'm just thinking, I went to some conventions in the late 80s, and the kind of people we had along there were, say, Katie Manning, but that was because she lived in Sydney.
Yes.
Or we had Mark Strickson come out and his wife Julie Brennan, who was in Paradise Towers. Again, yes. they had just moved to Australia. We had Dudley Simpson at something. He is an Australian. So, you know, it was very hard to get the overseas guests, and a lot of the ones I saw at first were simply because they were locals. You know.
Well, that's right. The first convention I went to was in 1990, I think, and the three guests we had were Dudley Simpson, who lived here, Robert Jewell, who played a Dalek in the first dozen or so Dalek stories, who lived here, and Alexandra Tynan, the costume designer, who lived here. So no on-screen, well, I suppose you could count Robert Jewell's on-screen talent, except he was hidden in a Dalek case, but not what you think of as being A-list stars, because that's all we had.
That's right, and I think at Console 88 here in Sydney, I got a Kevin Mansa autograph, and he was also a Dalek.
Oh, there you go.
So a similar sort of story, I think.
Yeah.
All right, now, of these conventions, I mean, you mentioned, was it four Doctor's signatures in there you have?
Yes, I've got Doctors 5, 6, 7 and 8.
Right. Which was the first one you met, and how was it meeting your first doctor?
The first doctor I would have met would have been Sylvester McCoy. And that was a weird one because he was incredibly jet-lagged and he was extremely grumpy.
Oh, no.
And, yeah, he was just very, very tired. He'd come straight out to Australia, hadn't really had time to get over the jet lag. And the one thing I found about Sylvester McCoy is if you pair him with somebody else, like a Sophie Aldred or even, like, you know, a Gary Russell interviewing him, he's really quite engaging. But on his own, he's a little bit shy and a little bit forgetful, so that was a very strange experience, but certainly the first time, as you say, you stand at an autograph desk with a doctor in front of you and say, would you please sign this to David, was a little bit surreal, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, being a little while ago now, I'm presuming, when was this?
Sylvester McCoy would have been about 2000.
About 2000. So he's 15 years younger than he is today. He would have looked a bit more like his on-screen persona,
yeah.
I guess, as well.
Absolutely, a little bit of grey there, but otherwise, yeah, he looked like the Doctor, definitely.
Yeah, gosh. All right, so moving on from Sylvester, who was your second Doctor?
Colin Baker was a year later, and both of these were in Sydney. We travelled up to see them.
Okay, and did you approach Colin thinking, or did you sit down for his talk thinking, oh, is he going to be like Sylvester, is he going to be jet-lagged, or how did you feel?
It was actually interesting. The evening before the convention, there was a little cocktail party that you could either be invited to if you knew there are people or buy your way into. And I was fortunate enough to be invited to this. And so I was just standing there with my friend Richard, also from the Melbourne Club, and we were chatting, and suddenly Colin Baker came over to us and just started talking to us. And he's, you know, people talk about actors and, you know, the nice ones and the lovely ones, but Colin is the nicest on-screen talent of any show I have ever met. He's a lovely, lovely man. And he's able to chat to you just so casually about all sorts of things. I think at the time we were gearing up for an Ashes tour, and he was chatting to us about the cricket for a while, and then he started talking about Australian rules football, because he saw I had my Australian rules club, Carlton. I was wearing Apollo top with their colours on, and he started talking about local football versus English football, and it's just a really nice, genuine chat. He's really good at making small talk and just a lovely, lovely man. And so then we went on to the formal convention, and he's one of those guests that really puts on a show. You know, he commands the stage when he's on. He doesn't just answer questions. He acts and he delivers a story, tells stories. And he's a really nice guy and a really good guest. That was a very special memory for me.
Oh, good. It's nice to hear stories like that. And I guess the famous story, which you would know, is there's a John Nathan Turner was particularly impressed by Colin at a wedding, I think, or something like that.
Yes, that's right.
And wanted to cast him as the Sixth Doctor. And a lot of people have, you know, thought, is that really the best way to pick a Doctor? But, you know, we'll put that aside for the moment. Did you have a John Nathan Turner moment then and think, yeah, I can see why this guy would be so engaging and just picked as the Doctor by the producer?
Picking him as the Doctor outright, I'm not sure about that, but if you had a short list of good actors and Colin was on it, and you're asking who's the guy that can actually sell this show, then that would get Colin across the line. I could absolutely see that making a lot of sense, because you put him in a room with some executives or with a chat show host or a bunch of reporters or fans, Colin will sell Doctor Who to you, and you'll walk away going, I like this guy, I want to watch his show. And so I do actually get a little bit of where James was coming from there.
Yeah, and you get that sense from some of the clips that are on the Doctor Who DVDs of UK chat shows where Colin's just taken the role. And I think there's one he appears on with Peter Davison. Peter Davison, who I love and who was my Doctor, comes across as a bit of a wet squib in comparison to Colin, you know? So I totally get where you're coming from.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Very, very lovely man.
All right, your third Doctor.
Well, it's a tie for that one, because we've actually moved away now from the fan-run traditional conventions I used to go to, which was one or two guests that, you know, the membership of about 100 managed to get enough money to get them to come to the con, and it was all fan-run, to the age of the professional convention where, you know, business people are actually making money, bringing out multiple stars and having large professionally run events, which has pros and cons. But on this particular occasion, they did a convention down here that had both Peter Davison and Paul McGann. and I think I would have met Paul McGann 5 minutes earlier than Davison, simply because he was first in the autograph queue. So it's almost like twins, you know. Paul McGann beats Davison by about 5 minutes, but they're basically a tie.
How did you find meeting these guys?
Paul McGann was really interesting because we'd seen him wandering around the convention a little bit earlier and during the introductions, and we got the impression he's a guy who doesn't suffer fools gladly, and you know he's not going to be bossed around by conventional lackeys. He's going to turn up when he's ready, and he's going to talk about what he wants. And so I was a little bit intimidated by that appearance, and so I got there and asked for the autograph, and he wasn't warm in the way that others were. But then I said, look, I just want to let you know, I particularly enjoyed you in the Hornblower series. I thought that was really wonderful. And suddenly his eyes sort of lit up, and it was almost to go, oh, there's a different topic to talk about now. And he started engaging with me about Hornblower and, you know, how he would love to do them, but Ian Griffin's off making too much money in Hollywood now to do them, and all that sort of thing. And he actually had a really good conversation with me. And I do wonder sometimes if for some of these people, getting a question that's different to the usual two or three they always get in an autograph queue is something they kind of value, if you like, or engages them a little bit more. So that was a really good conversation I had that I wasn't necessarily expecting. So that was nice. But, I mean, Paul McGann is a very honest person. He'll answer a question and tell you the truth.
Yeah, I should say, first of all, I did love the Hornblowers as well. He was Mr. Bush in Hornblower, wasn't he?
That's right, yes, yes.
Was his character. Yeah, he was great. He was great in that. But Paul McGann, thinking back, there was a period where I don't think he knew if he wanted to be into fandom and conventions and things like that. Can you remember that period of...
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of get it as well. He was in the show for, what, about an hour by the time he'd regenerated and woken up. So for an hour's worth of TV screen, you're meant to go and do a two-hour question and answer panel. You kind of get him going, what have I got to say? Mm. But I think now fandom's moved on enough, we kind of know so much about the telly movie and all that, that most people aren't asking questions about that anymore. They're talking about him and his career. And when we went on to his panel later on in the day, he spoke really, really interestingly about the changes that he's seen in the industry and the different roles he's had. And that was actually quite interesting. He also talked a bit about his friendship with Christopher Eccleston, which was very interesting. And somebody said to him, oh, do you think Christopher Eccleston will ever come to a convention? And Paul McGann said, oh, look, Chris and I have been friends since we were, you know, teenagers growing up, and we've been in plays together and we've struggled together. He's a really good friend and good man. I love him as an actor. And the interviewer said, yes, but do you think he'll ever come to a convention? Yeah, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So that was quite an honest answer. But, yeah, McGann, I mean, let's face it, how many questions can you answer about one episode of Doctor Who? Mm. But he's had a really varied career. I mean, he's done... Now, stuff like the Hanging Girl, for example, which is a wonderful little piece of television from the 90s that he's just done so many different things that he's quite an interesting guest, besides the Doctor.
Yeah, and I guess he's got the Big Finish stuff, but I find, although it's critically acclaimed by some, most fans don't listen to Big Finish. You know, for one reason or another, there's too much of it, it's too expensive, they don't know it exists, you know. The majority of fans, I would say, don't listen to it, so I guess he doesn't even get a lot of Big Finish questions.
He certainly gets some, but, I mean, as you say, there's a segment of fandom that seems to be dedicated to Big Finish, and a large segment that isn't, and in the middle there are people like me who, you know, dip in and out occasionally when a particular series interests them, like, you know, the Andrew Cartwell Season 27 series, I grabbed because I thought that was really interesting, but... You know, I don't earn $500,000 a year, so I can't buy every Big Finish release that comes out, even if I wanted to.
That's my problem with it as well. If I started collecting, I'd want them all, you know, or at least any of the Doctors that I'm into. But even then, you know, if I just want to collect all the Davison ones, ridiculous money.
It is. That's unfortunate, but it's the reality. So, yeah, some people were very, very excited about his Big Finish. He's certainly got questions. But the problem is, if you're one of those fans who's only listen to one or two McGann Big Finishes, then you really have no point of reference to understand what these questions are about. So
that's right. And even with what I understand of McGann on Big Finish, because there was a sale once and I bought his first run of six or eight different discs, it all changes over time, and they've sort of almost rebooted and restarted him in different ways, and they've even changed his costume and done all sorts of things, and I have no idea what's going on with that later stuff. You know, I'd only be able to talk about his really early stuff, which, you know, I don't think people even rate much anymore.
Yeah, well, look, that's very much the case. People do talk very well about some of his later stuff, and, you know, if ever I was to go and do another bit of a Big Finish spree, that would probably be top of the list of what I would go for. But, you know, I also sort of sit there and go, well, is this really a part of... Yeah, how much do you judge Paul McGann's character by what's happened 20 years after the telly movie in a niche little audio range, as opposed to what was actually on screen? Then you've also got the Eighth Doctor books. I mean, he's a very strange Doctor to analyse, because you've got so many different interpretations, but only 1 hour of actual on-screen time.
I'd go a step further and say Doctor Who canon is hard to analyse.
that's exactly right. And, you know, some people will tell you that there are companions of the Eighth Doctor that I have never heard of, but they are legitimate canon companions, and I find it very interesting, as somebody who's such a fan of the show, to think that there could be companions out there I don't even know the names of, let alone what they're like.
Mm.
That's a really strange sort of feeling.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I read the Eighth Doctor Adventure novels from start to finish, and so to me there are companions in there like, say, Fitz Kreiner.
Yeah.
He is as real to me as many of the TV companions, but if I say, what do you think of Fitz, to the average fan, they'd have no idea what I'm talking about. But in a similar way, some of these Big Finish companions, if people talk to me about them, I'd have no idea. Then you have Night of the Doctor, where Stephen Moffat wrote in some of those Big Finish companions. The next thing you've got fans running around, arms waving, oh, they're legit.
That's absolutely right. I did say to somebody who very forcefully was telling me in a meeting once, no, these are now canon because they have been in Night of the Doctor. And I said, well, you're assuming Night of the Doctor's canon. I mean, isn't it just a YouTube clip? And I had my tongue very much in my cheek, and unfortunately they didn't, so they didn't get the joke. But, you know, you can spin these things all the way around. And at the end of the day, as long as you're enjoying the show or the product or the book or the CD, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I've always found, though, Doctor Who canon, unlike other franchises where they try and establish what is canon and what isn't.
Yes.
And Star Wars in particular has gone really out of its way to do that in the past year or so. Doctor Who has always been very wishy-washy and very much leaving it up to the fans. It hasn't even tried to sort of establish what is real and what isn't.
I've always been a fan of the approach of Rob Grant and Doug Naylor with Red Dwarf continuity, where they said very openly from the start, if it's a choice between sticking to continuity or telling a good story, we're telling a good story. And if that means we have to rewrite a bit of continuity or ignore a bit of continuity, who cares? We're there to actually entertain people, not to create an encyclopedia. And I respect that.
Fair enough, too. All right, so moving down this this queue, you're approaching my favourite doctor, my doctor, Peter Davison. Tell us all about him.
I have to say, Peter Davison, I saw on a panel with Janet Fielding. Mm-hmm. And the two of them are the embodiment of a Holmesian double act. They've got their shtick down, they've got their stories down, they give a really genuine, laugh-out-loud, entertaining performance. And you can see Peter Davison, you know, Peter Davison is a very consummate actor, and a very consummate entertainer, and that really comes across when he does his Q&As. It is interesting, though, because he's another one who did go through the I don't want to be associated with fandom, I want this sort of show to be out of my life for a while period.
Very, very much so, yeah.
And so you do, for those of us who lived through that period, you do look at him sometime and go, have you just genuinely mellowed with age, or did the credit card bill get a little high and it was now time to start doing fan appearances? And I hate to be cynical, and I hope that's not the case, but that does sort of sit at the back of your mind, and particularly when you're sitting with Janet Fielding, who's also not known for her consistent love of Doctor Who. to see the two of them there. But in some ways that makes it more interesting, because you know that when they say they love a particular story or writer, then they actually mean it. Because if it's something like, for example, Black Orchid, which they both hate, and they both clearly dislike Terence Dudley as a writer, you know, you actually hear their genuine opinions, and they're not all about every story we did was wonderful and we loved working with every cast, and you know that that's not true.
Yeah.
So when they say, well, we got to Black Orchid, we thought this script sucked. That's actually quite interesting.
Yeah, and that's why I like the DVD commentaries from the classic era DVDs, because they're all generally so honest, particularly in the Davison era ones.
The Davison ones are particularly good, and there's some good McCoy ones as well. There's a wonderful commentary to Battlefield where Andrew Carlton and Ben Aaronovich are sort of talking about the script and the story with the hindsight of another 15, 20 years of experience as a writer, and they're not shredding it, they're really highlighting things they'll do differently now with more experience. And at one point, Sophie Aldred actually stops him and goes, "Guys, I really like this story. Stop making fun of it. It's a really good story." And those are, I think, the most interesting questions or commentaries or whatever. That, and I think that's why the JNT biography that came out 3 years ago was so interesting as well, because, again, you got this unvarnished, honest view of what was good and what was bad, and that's so much more interesting than Spin.
Yeah, absolutely. It's why when I read Doctor Who magazine at the moment, the contemporary cast talking about making the show, you know it's probably not entirely the truth. You know there's truth to it, of course, but there's probably stories they want to tell but can't. But in maybe 15, 20 years, we will hear those stories.
Yeah, I kind of rather cynically dubbed Doctor Who magazine as the Pravda of Cardiff. It's the propaganda arm of the organisation. That's perfectly valid, but you're right. You don't go there looking for the tell-all or the unvarnished truth. It's there to entertain and spin and sell a story, so
yeah,
that's fine.
I find the classic era stuff in there a bit like the commentaries does get some good stuff in, but if it's current stuff, no.
Yeah, no. And nor could you expect them to. I mean, that's the relationship they have. If they want to get these exclusives, they have to keep on selling, and that's a commercial reality. But we now have podcasts that can tell everybody the honest truth and have different opinions, and that's why I really enjoy the podcast scene now.
Absolutely. Well, look, as we come up to time, you mentioned that Terence Dix has signed this, but you also mentioned a lot of companions have signed this as well.
Yes.
Out of Terence and all those companions, let's pick one more anecdote, one more meeting you've had that was memorable, that stood out for some reason, and let us know about that.
I'll very quickly say Terence is the one that got me most starstruck because of the influence he had on my childhood. That was a really special moment. But I'll tell you the story about meeting Fraser Hines, because he's another really good bloke. And he came to Australia and he was doing a couple of events, and our club had organised to do an interview with him for our fanzine. And towards the end of the day, Richard, our president at the time, approached him and said, "Look, how do you want to do this interview?" And Fraser said, "Well, informally, if possible." To which Richard said, "Well, the committee's actually going to the pub afterwards. Why don't you come with us and do it there?" So suddenly, Fraser Hines was coming to the pub with us, and a few SMSs went out to a few friends, one of whom didn't believe we were telling the truth that Fraser Hines was coming to the pub and didn't turn up.
No.
And to this moment, regrets it, because we actually got Fraser to call him at the end of the night and tell him he made the mistake. But to actually find myself standing at the bar of the pub with Fraser Hines, who said to me, "Oh, you're getting a wine?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you want white?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, how about I buy the first bottle, you buy the second, and we'll see about the third."
Nice.
And there's me drinking a bottle of wine with Fraser Hines, who's just talking so openly and lovingly about Wendy Padbury and Deborah Watling and Patrick Troughton. And so that was a really special moment for me as a fan.
Yes, and I've been to many Supernova conventions, which for people overseas aren't just Doctor Who conventions, they're more generic pop culture conventions. And
yes.
I remember one in particular where Richard Hatch was there. He was Apollo in the original Battlestar Galactica. He was Tom Zarek in the reimagined Battlestar Galactica. And he came out drinking with us after a Supernova one night. And we're in a tiny pub in Sydney in the Rocks. And he's drinking, he's dancing to this folk band that's in the corner. And it was an experience I'll never forget. It was beyond standing in front of an autograph table. It was beyond watching someone talk on stage and tell stories they've told a million times before. It was really, really special.
Yeah, I understand exactly what you mean.
All right. Well, I guess all that's left to do now is put a value on something like this. And when it comes to something like this, how can you put a value on it? But I guess for people out there who are interested in picking up a copy of Time Frame, there is the hardcover and the softcover we mentioned earlier. You'd probably look at, in my experience, and David, you can jump in as well, probably around the $40 mark to $50 mark might secure you a hardcover.
Yes.
And for the soft cover, maybe 20 to 30. You may even find some ratty copies of the soft cover for less than that. And that will get you the book.
Yes. I think that's right. If you want a really pristine copy, I think they go up to about $70, $80 because, you know, it's got the old school dust cover and they do get a bit damaged. So a nice one, $70, $80, but yeah, you can get it for $30, $40 for sure.
Yeah, if you're not too fussy on appearance, I guess.
Yeah.
And I guess as these books get older, and they were fairly niche books to begin with, beggars can't be choosers sometimes with some books. I know there are a few in my collection I wish were in better condition, but they were all I could find.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And, you know, you buy them to read and to enjoy, so mine's got a couple of little batters, but who cares?
Yeah. Now, in terms of autographs, I mean, people out there will know if you're in the UK, you're probably paying £10 to £20 an autograph. Out here, you're paying maybe $20 up to $50 for an autograph. So very hard to put an exact figure on. But if we had to, your book's worth in the vicinity of, you know, several hundred dollars easily. You know,
I would think so. But it's worth more to me.
That's right, and that's why you won't be selling it, I imagine. So
that's exactly right.
Please don't write in asking if David will sell this. I would like it very much on my shelf, but I'm sure it's staying firmly on yours.
Very, very much so.
All right. Well, thank you so much for bringing that in today, David, and for being on Who Teaks Roadshow.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome to the TARDIS Library, a place to talk comics, novels, audios, and more from the worlds of Doctor Who.
Hello, this is Mark Suter, reviewing The 10th Doctor, issue number 2.5. The Doctor and Gabby are still caught between two factions as modern humanity is born. Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons clash, and their actions will shape the direction taken by humankind in the millennia to come. All right, well, let's get out of the way the couple annoyances that I had. Once again, we have Monmouth the Caveman, and his thought bubbles are drawn jaggedly and the writing is rough and it just doesn't really mesh with his character. The art is a little bit better. The issue with the coloring and too much contrast between dark and light is mostly solved in this issue, I feel. And the once again, the art actually conveys the spirit and the feeling of the characters, and some better art on the Doctor himself. He really does look more like David Tennant throughout the issue. Other than that, it was a really solid issue. The story was good. Monmouth and the Doctor find themselves in sort of an arena, and they're facing off against different enemies, and when they beat them, they disappear, which, you know, of course, frightens Monmouth because he's a caveman. But it's a transmat, and that's something we hear about all the time in Doctor Who. And there were many touchstones like that throughout the issue. The Doctor realizes quickly that they're in a hard light hologram arena, sort of like a gladiator arena, and he uses his sonic screwdriver to mess with it. And again, just over and over throughout this issue, they're just nailing it with the way the Doctor speaks, the way he acts, the things he does, the actions he takes. It just really all works. At the beginning of the issue, of course, we pick up with Gabby's story, and she has been picked up by opposing forces to the aliens, which turns out to be a mixture of humans and aliens from what looks to be the same time period that we're in, because some of them don't think that time travel is possible. They are trying to make sure that the Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons are not used as hard labor. So they are sort of resistance fighters, I guess you'd say. At first they think that Gabby's one of the enemy, but then they eventually team up with her and everybody gets together by the end of the issue, which was going to be an excellent conclusion to this two-parter, but it turns out there's a bigger bad. The main bad guy calls for a time bridge and they are all sucked up in a time tornado. Well, that's not what it's called, but that's what it looks like. And they are transported to who knows where. That's where To Be Continued comes in. So really, overall, this issue is a solid 4.5. I'd give it a 5 for story, 4 for art, and there's your average. Also, it had that one-page comic about Rose the Cat. Also, a very amusing story. I'd recommend picking this one up. And I look forward to the next issue. Once again, this is Mark Suter, and you can follow me on Twitter at Mark E. Suter. And you can hear my podcasting voice on Tarkin's Top Shelf, which is a new book review podcast, and also on Idiot's Array, which is sort of a general discussion of canon about Star Wars.
Hello, I'm Kevin, and welcome to the TARDIS Library, where this month I'm going to be looking at the first issue of the Year 2 of the 12th Doctor comic from Titan Publishing. As I mentioned last month, this new run of comics is set during Series 9 of the TV series. And that's something that's very clear from the very first opening page where they introduce the characters and things like that, as it mentions Missy and a Dalek plan and Cybermen and Clara becoming a bit too much like the Doctor. So it's obviously set sometime after Magician's Apprentice, which is familiar, during the middle of Series 9. The writer for this issue is Robbie Morrison, returning from having done the previous series. And the artist is Rachel Stott, who has done some Star Trek Planet of the Apes comics for IDW. The main plot of the issue concerns mysterious goings-ons at a remote Scottish school for privileged children. One of Clara's school-teaching friends has gone missing, and she leaves a mysterious message on Clara's phone. The thing is, the Doctor's nowhere to be found. He's off having his own adventures. So Clara takes it upon herself to go undercover, manages to get a job at the school, and goes up to Scotland to investigate what's going on. When she gets there, all of a sudden, the Doctor turns up, and the two of them meet the headmistress of the school, the very strict Mrs. Mariner, and the PE teacher, who has a bit of a thing for Clara. And the issue ends with the PE teacher finding a cave full of very green egg-shaped things, and these amphibian-type creatures pop out of the eggs and start attacking everybody. So it's all very odd and all very scary, and we don't really know at this point exactly what's going on and what these creatures are. And it's a great first issue, you know, it makes you want to come back and read the next one. Writer Robbie Morrison has obviously been watching a lot of the episodes of Series 9. I mean, his dialogue for the Doctor sounds really like Peter Capaldi's performance in the current series. There's actually a lovely sequence in the middle of the issue where we discover that the Doctor's off on an alien spacecraft, and he's having a drink in the bar, and he's accosted by a gigantic space pirate called Lucifer Van Volk, who's obviously heard of the Doctor, but the Doctor's never met him before, at least not yet. And this whole sequence is full of just the kind of sarcastic quips that we've seen with Peter Capaldi in the ninth series, and it's really, really well done. And the dialogue here is just full of Easter eggs for fans of TV and comics. The ship's called the Rosette of Sirius, which any UK comic fan will tell you is the green dial thing on the head of Tharg, the alien editor of 2000 AD. The shipping line's called the Enidian Interstellar Line, which is from a famous 1970s TV series. The Doctor's in the bar and he's having pangalactic gargle blasters, obviously made famous from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And then when he is introduced to Lucifer Van Volk, he says, "Oh, I don't know anybody of that name, but I didn't know a Van Dyne or a Von Doom," both of which are characters from Marvel Comics. He also refers to a couple of his predecessor incarnations as a mophead with a fedora and a rainbow scarf, a skinny chap who's always apologising, and a bow-tied whippersnapper with a chin that you can balance a drink on. It's really, really good. The last thing I'd mention is that the school up in Scotland's called Ravenscour, which I thought might be a homage to Ravenscar, which was the asylum from the Hellblazer comics. But actually it turns out that it's a name from the Narnia Chronicles. And obviously there's a Ravenscraig and a Ravenscliff and lots of other places named that up in Scotland anyway. Art-wise, from Rachel Stott, it's lovely stuff. I mean, it's not quite the kind of detailed cross-hatching and rubble-strewn things that we were getting from the artist and when I talked about last month. But the it's very, very well drawn. The likenesses are really, really good. The facial expressions are great. And she does draw some really good amphibious creatures. Be interesting to see what she does next month when the story you know, grows a little bit and we've got more of the monsters. She does draw very, very good Scottish scenery, though, which is quite nice to see. All in all, I really, really enjoyed this issue, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the next one can hold. If I was to score it out of 10, I'd probably say it's probably a 7 or an 8. It's perhaps not the most original of storylines, but no, it's a really good comic. Right, that's enough from me for this month. See you next time.
Well, here we are at the end of the second Doctor Who show. My thanks to Ian, Bob, Jim, Mark and Kevin for their segments, and of course our guests Hayden Gribble and David Kitchen for their time as well. To close this episode, I've selected the topic of the X-Files versus Doctor Who. Now, we've just had a new mini-series of X-Files running on the television. Australia was getting, I think, about a week behind the US. The UK was 2 or 3 weeks behind, so it's been a little tricky to talk to some of you who I know in real life about the episodes, because we've all been sort of all over the place. But something I've noticed, and which I've said from the start because it's not a spoiler, is that the mini-series felt like a compressed full-length series of X-Files. It had arc episodes, it had a serious episode, it had the comedy episode, it had the scary episode, and so on and so forth. And this is the way X-Files was always written. And X-Files fans, and I've been one since season one back in the day, in the early 90s, X-Files fans have always lapped up this kind of diversity. Doctor Who fans, meanwhile, and of course I'm one of those as well, no surprises there, Doctor Who fans seem more inclined to have or to desire series or seasons, if we're talking back in the day, that had more of an overall tone that can be latched onto. For example, you know, people talk about the Douglas Adams season 17, which had, you know, a very light and funny and weird sort of tone. Or Philip Hinchcliffe's 3 seasons, you know, it's known as the Gothic era. But wouldn't it be great in a show that's all about change that things were mixed up a bit and we had episodes that were more distinctly comedy or more serious or more arc or scary or even musical? You know, when you think of a particular Buffy episode and how much fun that was. And, you know, that we as fans could just take that in our stride, like X-Files fans do. You know, there have been exceptions at times. Something like The Lodger comes immediately to mind as an episode with some deliberately comedic stuff in it. But you still couldn't call it a full-on comedy episode. No, our series really seems to be rooted in a singular look and feel across each series, if not multiple series. And I think that all comes back to the concept of a sole showrunner, which I'm finding actually more and more people are starting to query. And I guess it's funny that I'm mentioning this now, because with Chris Chibnall coming on board for the next 4 or 5 years at least, you would assume, you know, the showrunner concept is here to stay for a little while longer at least. But I know a lot of people out there would like to see Doctor Who maybe take on more of a writer's room kind of feeling, where, sure, there's still someone sitting at the top of the tree, but they have more people around them more often making more decisions. You know, it's more like how American television is run, and I think people point to a lot of really quality American TV that's been made in the last 5 years, or say 10 years, perhaps, at a stretch. And it does come down to this format, the way they write the episodes. It's not one person left in charge of everything. I guess budget would play into this to some degree. US television shows, even small ones, have budgets that would make, you know, the British or the Australians down here, for example, just, you know, goggle. You know, what, you're paying that much just for craft services? What, that's our budget for an entire episode? You know, whatever it might be. And I guess we're left with this situation where so much gets lumped on one person, which wouldn't be lumped on one person in other markets, that it does create this sense that a whole series feels very samey because it's coming from the same person. I'd really like to see Doctor Who made differently, I think. The more I think about it, the more I think of the X-Files example and the way, as I say, X-Files fans just take it in their stride. Oh, this episode's bizarre and funny and nothing like we saw last week, but that's okay because that's par for the course. You know, what do you think anyway? Do you have any thoughts on this or anything that we discussed on the show today? Why not drop us a line at hello@thedwshow.net and we'll read it out on the next episode. Speaking of next episode, we'll see you in a month's time in episode number 3. Take care. You've been listening to The Doctor Who Show, the podcast where too much Doctor Who is barely enough. Subscribe to us on iTunes or listen through the website at www.thedwshow.net. Write to us at hello@thedwshow.net or send us a quickie on Twitter @thedwshow. Facebook.com/thedwshow is also a good place to find us if you're so inclined. Our version of the Doctor Who theme arranged by George Locke. Look him up on YouTube, folks. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. Doctor Who, all names and sounds, and any other related items are trademarks and or copyrights of the BBC. All other trademarks and trade names are properties of their respective owners. The official Doctor Who website can be found at www.bbc.co.uk/Doctor Who.